for awarding contracts
go smoothly and transparently. And one of the ways that we can improve that is by having a record of conversations between the proposers and the department. And if I could just very quickly, over about 30 seconds, Mr. Chair, kind of walk through how that process works under design build. In design build, the teams are competing for the best design and the best building projects, the best construction value, and then it's not just a low bid competition. It's actually a sort of best value formula through which these projects are awarded. The department will put out a request for qualifications for teams that superpose. They'll then create a short list from their request for qualifications. They will then submit a request for proposals, an RFP, to those teams on the short list, who will then work in confidence, separate from each of the other proposers, with the department to propose design ideas. The department will then provide feedback and a critical perspective, and then ultimately the teams will need to reward or present their proposals. The intellectual property of the proposers is protected and is only the property of the department after a stipulated fee or a stipend is then awarded and accepted. The review for the criteria, the scoring methodology, and the proposal evaluations are then released. Some of you might remember, if you were there or heard about the 35W Bridge contract, just as an easy way to understand that the scores were released at one point, and then the department does the due diligence to make sure that the proposers are bonded and are qualified to do the building and do the constructing, and it's a fully responsive proposal, at which point the project is awarded. The provision that we just amended a little bit on the bottom of page 4 then will create a 7-day delay between the award of the project and the execution of the contract. Once the project is awarded, the new audio recordings, along with the existing criteria in Section 1, will be public data. And I believe that really outlines the process and outlines the reason that we're here before you. So I will stand for questions. I do have individuals here who are ready to help with any technical questions if they arise.
Before we get to other testifiers, people who are opposed to the bill, do we have any questions for members? Okay. Do you have any other testifiers?
I think that only to answer questions as we proceed. I do think that Betsy Parker from MnDOT may want to comment. At this point, I think that we've worked very, very well with them on this section. We have a lot more work to go on the others, so I don't want to force MnDOT to comment if they feel like I've adequately described the process. And
Ms. Parker, you need not testify if you prefer not to, but I'd invite any testifiers on the bill for or against.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. I wasn't sure whether we would see an amendment tonight, so we've only just seen the amendment. I would say in general that the department is opposed to the bill. I understand you're only taking up data practices issues tonight. The one thing that the department had agreed to from the entire bill was this language that says the commissioner shall wait at least 7 days from the time that the project is awarded and the technical scores of the proposers are revealed until the execution of the contract. So we had said before that we would agree to that kind of language, but not to anything else in the bill.
Okay. Questions from members?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had looked at the bill as introduced, and obviously this is a delete all and quite extensive, so can I just ask a few questions of the author?
Sure.
So you are no longer requiring disclosure of all the information until after the contract is signed? You haven't changed that in this delete all. So in other words, where your bill is introduced would require disclosure in that interim. Where are we at with your delete all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, the audio recordings and the other data that is information that's currently in statute and subdivisional in section that's reflected in section one would be public when the project is awarded, so before that 7 day period. So after the score and is released and the due diligence.
And so
we're only adding one.
Mr. Chair, and currently those things that can become public are awarded after the contract is signed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, they're actually when the project is awarded rather than the contract is not always, is actually not executed at the time of award. I believe there's a short delay between those two, and we're actually, I believe that delay might even be 24 hours currently, or Ms. Parker could elucidate on that point, but I think that right now it would become 7 days, and we think that's an appropriate time to do, for the proposers to do full due diligence after seeing the award and the other proposals.
Sir, then what happens if a contract is never signed? If the final contract isn't signed?
Ms. Parker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, if the contract were not signed, we would probably be sorry that we had released the data. But generally, we make public the information at award, which is when we send the letter to the bidder in a low bid contract or to the proposer saying, you are the one sending your final papers, and then we'll execute the contract. So at that point, we have examined everyone's submissions and determined who is the winner of the contract, whether it's a low bid or a design build. And making other information public at award is consistent with the statutes governing the Department of Administration that make such information public at the completion of the selection process.
Mr. Chair, and Ms. Parker, have you had time to review this delete all amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I have flipped through this amendment. In general, we don't like it, but this particular language on page 4 from line 33 to line 35 is identical to language that appeared in the original bill as introduced that we had said that we would not object to.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Holberg, I want to add that you've had several conversations. I've had several conversations with Ms. Parker and with MnDOT to go through each of the provisions of the bill. I actually even have our notes from last Friday, sort of working through what are remaining issues of discussion. And I think we felt like the items before this committee were subjects that we had thoroughly covered in terms of substance. And so I think Ms. Parker's statement is a good reflection on the levels of agreement on what's here before this committee. We will be meeting with our stakeholders, including MnDOT, tomorrow morning to continue to flesh out as many of those items of discussion that are, let's see in my notes, there's some that we've worked out and some that still need some discussion, so we are by no means ready to go to transportation on a transportation report, but we feel like we have taken MnDOT consideration or request into consideration actually accommodated as much as we possibly can on the provision. You'll note that I did have the, originally in the bill, we did have the required recording of every, all oral communications to promptly summarize in writing, and that was clearly unworkable, and while the
spirit was fine, the
technical workability was the quotient was pretty low, so we wanted to increase our
technical review committee score on that element and
get it up.
Any other questions of these testifiers from members? Any other folks in the audience here to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3301 as amended recommended to pass and sent to the full House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion failed. Next bill on the calendar is House File 3302. I saw Representative Atkins here earlier. Is he here now? He must have stepped out. Okay. In that case, maybe we will take up House File 3161. And members, Representative Bigham called this afternoon. She's very, very sick, so she can't be here. So I will move that House File 3161 be recommended to pass and be sent from here to the House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. She's not here, but I have a feeling that there are others that are here to testify on the bill. Is that true, House File 3161, Representative Bigham? Anyone here to testify for or against the bill? Well, I'll do my best then. There's a... Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. There is now, I see, a delete everything amendment. Does everyone, the members have the delete everything amendment? Okay. There's a delete everything amendment. Now, it was represented to me by Representative Bigham that this was a consensus delete everything amendment, so I'm taking her at her word that no one has a problem with this. If there are any members of the audience who do have a problem with it, then we certainly want to hear from you. But I'll move the delete everything amendment. Okay, just the DE1 amendment. Do members have any comments or questions on the DE1 amendment to Representative Bigham's bill? Okay, with that, all in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. Now on to the bill itself. My understanding, and again, this is all on the fly, that this would enable a list to be made of Minnesota deceased military personnel for certain memorial purposes and other purposes. My understanding from Representative Bigham is that this is not a controversial bill, that various stakeholders agree on this, but I'll happily entertain testimony from anyone who knows anything differently. As I said before, Representative Bigham is... You don't have the amendment. Okay. Well, I think members ought to have a chance to look at what they're voting on. So I'd like to, yeah, why don't we do this? Well, why don't we have Mr. Gehring explain the amendment? Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair and members, this bill, as Representative Simon indicated, allows or requires the Department of Veterans Affairs to compile a list of deceased veterans from Minnesota or who have ties to Minnesota who died as a result of combat-related or service-related causes. A change from the first engrossment that was brought to this committee that's in the Delete Everything Amendment is an allowance for next of kin to request that data not be disclosed to for ceremonial or honorary purposes to veterans organizations and civic organizations. This will be done by a request in writing from the next of kin to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and upon such a request, the data would not be disseminated. The Delete Everything also establishes a cross-reference to data in Chapter 13, and apart from that, it's basically in substance the same as the first engrossment of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. So if I understand correctly, Mr. Gehring, this is an obvious opt-out.
Right, yes.
So the presumption is that this information would be released or could be used for the purposes stated in the bill. Because you should by now have a copy of the DE1 amendment to House File 3161. If you just want to take a second to look at it, members, and if you have any questions or comments, I know this is sort of on the fly, but such is the nature of our subcommittee here. Okay. Members have any other concluding thoughts or questions or concerns? Okay. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3161, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent from here to the House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, the next bill on the calendar is House File 3302, Representative Atkins.
Can
There's a DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I will move that House File 3302 be recommended to pass and sent to the full House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Sam is to delete everything.
The 3302 DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair, it'll put it in the shape that I and the reviser would like to move forward with it.
Why don't we act on that right now? I'll move the DE1 amendment to House File 3302. All in favor of adding the DE1 amendment to House File 3302, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
The bill is amended.
Chair and members, and I'm joined today by Karen Schaefer, who's with the Dakota County Attorney's Office, as well as Commissioner Nancy Schulweiler, who are both behind me. Karen is going to testify with respect to the bill, but it's a very natural and necessary outgrowth of the open meeting law exception for certain non-public data. Very simply, when you're dealing with a real estate transaction, and there's obviously you don't want the world to know what the substance of the negotiations are, you're allowed under the open meeting law to have that be non-public. You have to record it, obviously. And then once the transaction is either completed or abandoned, then you release those tapes and everybody can listen and see what all took place. But you don't have to worry about that information going public when it would be detrimental to the negotiations. A natural outgrowth of that, but one that was overlooked, was that if there is printed material that, in this instance, county commissioners, or when I was a mayor, if there's printed materials, those are not currently protected. You literally, it dissuades the staff from putting anything in writing for commissioners and mayors and council members to study before they go into the negotiations, because that can instantly become public data. All this says is that if there are, in fact, printed documents with respect to these negotiations, that those are protected exactly as that tape is protected until the negotiations are either completed and a sale is transacted or until it's abandoned. So it's pretty obvious. With that, I will ask Ms. Schaefer to come up and provide her testimony to the extent there's anything that I may have missed. And I think they've actually had this instance arise, Mr. Chair and members, so they literally have first-hand experience with respect to it.
Schaefer, if you could state your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Karen Schaefer, and I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney. And I think Representative Atkins has really hit the nail on the head. This is meant to be a very, very narrow protection for printed memo that the staff of a city or a county might prepare to aid the policymakers in making important decisions about the sale or the purchase of real estate. And these documents would all become public eventually. The question has been asked of me, well, the appraisals are already private, you don't have to worry about those. And that's true, but what's missing is the staff's analysis or the staff's recommendation or some negotiating techniques or particular points that might be relevant. You know, real estate is all about the particular parcel and the particular owners. So this is really meant to be as narrow as Representative Atkins represents.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holder.
If I might, just for clarification purposes, with this new definition, it would also include electronic records, just not paper, so it doesn't spell out. So in other words, if you use the computer to prepare your written materials, that would be classified as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, okay. The electronic version of that was underlays the paper document mailed to the commissioners would also be protected until the transaction is complete.
Members, any other questions for these testifiers? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify in favor or against the bill? I think we have someone in favor here. Why don't we do that first? If you could just state your name for the record and introduce yourself.
Scare me, Mr. Chair. When the county commissioner shows up, you ask for people that were opposed to it. No. We got a problem.
I'm for it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nancy Schulweiler, Dakota County Commissioner and Chair of the County Board. Imagine, if you will, you are sitting down with your realtor trying to determine whether to accept any one of a number of offers for your house. A potential buyer offers one amount contingent upon you put on a new roof. Another offer comes in, and it's contingent on whether or not you replace the front door and that buyer would like to purchase your piano. And there's a third scenario, whatever it may be. It may not be a realistic scenario for you, but as in a close meeting to discuss an offer or a counteroffer for the purchase of real property, without documentation, it can be just as confusing if you're the county board member sitting at that closed meeting. Add a few more six-digit numbers and five or six more people to the discussion, and it becomes more difficult to sort out which amount comes with which contingency, that sort of situation. And if you're like me, you go and you ask staff to prepare documentation that you can refer to during that discussion. But your county attorney advises that many documents provided for this closed session are considered public data and would have to be made available upon request. These are tough decisions, spending hundreds, if not thousands, of tax dollars, and you don't have any materials available to refer back to during the discussion. That's essentially the situation under the current open meeting law. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners respectfully request your consideration in changing this documentation made available under these circumstances that it would be private data until the time the transaction has been completed or abandoned. This is also the time when the mandatory tape recording becomes public. If this information was documented and became public data, the other party to the transaction would have the advantage of knowing how much the county board was willing to pay during the negotiating process. Under this situation, the price for the property could increase and cause the county to pay more than what is necessary. Without this amendment, staff told public officials should avoid preparing written materials for a closed meeting to discuss the proposed sale or purchase of real or personal property, adding to the difficulty and complexity of expensive and tough decisions. On behalf of the Dakota County Board of Commissioners, I thank you for your time and your consideration of our request.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members of the testifier? If not, then Representative Atkins, I will, fortunately or unfortunately, open up to comments from anyone who opposes the bill. Is there anyone here willing to testify or not willing, but is there anyone here who wishes to testify against House File 3302? Mr. Neumeister, please state your name for the record and identify yourself.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Neumeister. I am an open government and privacy advocate, so I try to balance the things here. Chairman, members of the committee, I've worked with Representative Holberg when this bill about the closed meeting about these things came up several years ago. And it was an arduous kind of process to where if you look on the delete everything, you'll see the three areas, 1, 2, and 3. It talks about what things is basically non-public. The proposal, I think, basically will make a lot of other things other than those three things non-public. And the public will never know, particularly the accountability. If you look at those three things, it's basically already the appraisal data, which is money type issues, a financial issue, the asking price, which is a financial item, and then the offers or counter offers are real specific to, again, money type issues. So one of the things that I have a fear about is that things that are not related to those three things, that the local government entity or the local body itself can say, well, we'll include this as part of the package. It might be drawings, it might be designs, it might be, you know, other kinds of communication with the developer other than those specific three things, and would not be available for maybe months down the line or whatever. And then one discovers down the line, when it's opened up eventually, hey, there's something smelling like rotten cheese in Denmark or whatever. Same, you know what I'm talking about. The rotten smell in Denmark. And so, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I basically am looking at the aspect of this of public accountability. And once we start doing this, we're tinkering then with the general open meeting. And so this is a broader issue. I think it's something that maybe down the line should be discussed a little bit more in detail. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, those are my comments.
Before we take comments or questions, why don't we go to the other testifier? I think it sounds like the newspapers have something to say about it. Identify yourself for the record.
That was a very perceptive guess, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Amphenson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Our concerns are similar to Richard's. The concept that this proposal is trying to get at is perfectly valid. We don't have a problem with that. In other words, protecting the same sorts of information that you're discussing in a closed meeting. And we did support this amendment to the open meeting law a few years ago for the reason that we think it makes some sense. The problem with the language, though, in the amendment as it appears before you is the scope is completely open-ended, as Richard touched on, because the classification, the private classification, hinges on materials prepared and distributed. There's no limitation to what that might be. You might suddenly find entirely public data classified now as not public. For example, a proposal by an owner of private property to sell that property to the government body currently is public data. If that's distributed to the county board in a closed meeting, it becomes potentially private data. How about a financial workup on the capacity of the public body to purchase and whether it should? That goes off the radar completely. So it's a scope problem. It goes potentially far beyond the boundaries of the exception to the open meeting law. We have talked to the author. We've talked to the county attorney. We are more than willing to continue to work with them. And we're optimistic these deficiencies can be corrected, however.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I just have a comment or question. On line 1.4 of the delete all amendment, that language seems to be pretty limited, at least from my standpoint. It says relating to the agenda of a meeting closed. That seems fairly tight. I don't see that much wiggle room for a clever, employee of a particular governing body to sort of shoehorn in there a bunch of stuff that will be placed before members in a meeting and that somehow shield it from public disclosure. That seems pretty tight to me. I mean, how do you...
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate what you're saying, but relating to the agenda is possibly purchasing or selling real estate. And a vast array of information could, quote-unquote, relate to that agenda item. So I respectfully would disagree with you. I think it's pretty open-ended.
Committee members, any questions? Representative Delaforce.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I apologize to my colleagues for being detained in another meeting, so I will withdraw my question if it's already been answered, but I also had a concern, and maybe Mr. Anfinson can weigh in, and certainly the author can weigh in as well, regarding scope on line 8 with the language regarding the governing body having abandoned the purchase or sale, and I'm not sure if that is defined in some other part of statute or not, but if I can also foresee a problematic situation where a governing body may be reluctant to begin the 8-year window by saying, well, we're still interested, we still have not abandoned our pursuit of this property. We may not, inquisitive citizen, be actively pursuing the property at this time, but rest assured, the city council, for example, we are still interested in purchasing the property. Therefore, we're not going to begin ticking any clocks for the foreseeable future, and you may create this sort of limbo. And it's a related issue, but folks might remember out in Shoreview, the Moundsview Schools, decades ago, purchased a plot of land for a new high school that sits vacant today, which has been the subject of lawsuits, not related to Chapter 13. But there's a similar situation where a governing body has said, we are so interested in doing something with real estate, yet we're not doing anything with it, and here we are decades down the road. I don't know if the witness or the author has a response to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeLaForest, that issue has come up because currently the tape of the closed meeting would become public once the transaction is abandoned, and there has been definite ambiguity about how you define abandonment, and it's really left to the discretion of the public body. Again, Mr. Chairman, I do want to be clear. I'm not going to tell you what your committee should do, but we are willing, if this bill moves forward, to work with the author and the proponents. I think we can craft something that will be an improvement. I just wanted, for the record, to register our concerns.
Thanks. Representative Atkins, any response?
On Representative DeLaForest's point, that language has actually been part of the statute since it was passed in 1999.
I think it's 2004, Mr. Chairman.
Give it some 5 years, give or take. But it's not a new term. This is the term that was used since it was originally passed, and that's why that language was used once again.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkinson, thank you. I understand. Fortunately, it's like the cereal box. You would find all sorts of surprises if you sit on subcommittees like this. But you know, we had an issue with in this committee with finding out that the government can just come on your land. It goes on and on. But I understand, Representative Atkinson. It still doesn't give me a lot of comfort, but thank you.
Any other questions or comments from committee members of any of the testifiers? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against the bill? If not, then I'll renew my motion that House File 3302, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the full House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks, Representative Atkins. Great. Oh, Representative Holder.
And I'm sorry if I missed this. Are you putting together an omnibus bill? Are you moving all of these separate? Or?
No. And thank you, Representative Holberg. I should say to those here, there are a few that are traveling on their own. So far, we've done the first three that are traveling on their own. I think there is one more that's traveling on its own, and that's Representative Mariani's House File 3816. So since I see Representative Mariani, I think it might make sense to do that before we get to the others. And just for those here in the audience, the vehicle bill for all of this, we intend at least, will be House File 3553, which is a technical bill. And then the other bills you see on the agenda here today will be in amendment form and will or won't, depending on the will of the subcommittee, be appended to that vehicle bill. But for public notice purposes, these were all thrown in the hopper as individual bills so that the public would have a chance to see what these are. So we're not marking up bills with ghost amendments, you know, in the dark of night. Representative Mariani, you have House File 3816, and I will move that House File 3816 be recommended to pass and sent to the full House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. Representative Mariani, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I appreciate your willingness to hear us here at the beginning of the long agenda today. House File 3816 comes from a very collaborative process that involves quite a bit of time and energy on the part of higher ed and K-12 institutions and representatives that are present in the P-16 partnership. And basically what we're trying to get at here is a better alignment between our K-12, and post-secondary, so that those systems can really inform and instruct one another well. And what we're specifically interested in is being able to attribute, if we can, post-secondary success with K-12 experiences. So what kind of courses, for instance, what kind of levels of rigor, you know, activities happening in the K-12 for the individual that may be attributed to success in post-secondary. That would help both post-secondary in terms of aligning its practices as well as K-12 aligning their practices with the other system. The problem in our state is that, however, that it's very difficult for us to track that kind of information once an individual leaves the K-12 system. And so this proposal would allow the two systems to share data with one another. The commissioners here can talk specifically about the type of data and the manner in which they're proposing to do that. None of this members is meant to be able to track John Lesser's, for instance, as much as we would love to do that. So yes, John Lesser's particular experiences and attribute, you know, however he does in post-secondary with whatever his experience was in K-12. So we would be stripping that out. So we're talking about aggregate information, not disaggregated information. So again, this is a way for us to be able to sort of get to the next level in our state in terms of a better alignment between what happens in K-12 connected to success in post-secondary. And I'm really excited about the analysis that can come from that in terms of not only how those systems can continue to adjust to one another, but how we in the legislature, armed with that kind of analysis, can direct our policies, our education policies, to further promote, you know, good practices, good experiences that are about aligning success between those two systems, as well as potentially for us to be able to target our allocation to both K-12 and post-secondary, informed by that kind of analysis. So members, that's the intent of the bill. There is an amendment that attempts to be more prescriptive about that data, to provide a little bit more comfort, I think, in terms of our concern for data, but also in terms of directing the kind of information analysis that we want. And I've got with us this evening the Commissioner of Department of Education, as well as our Office of Higher Education, who can talk about what their interests and how they intend to and how they foresee carrying out this.
Before we go to testify as Representative Mariani, I think this might be a good time to take your amendment up. Members, you should have it in your packets. It's the A1 amendment to House File 3816. I'll move the amendment. Representative Mariani, is there anything you want to amplify in particular about the amendment before we vote on it, or do you feel you've already done that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, again, this really prescribes the kind of information like student attendance, demographic and enrollment data, and academic performance and testing data. And Mr. Chair, I would also ask, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we have a small oral amendment.
Why don't we do that now so we incorporate it into your author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, that would be a very simple on line 1.8 of the bill, after the word job before department, insert Minnesota. On the bill.
On the actual bill. Okay.
Well, maybe we should wait until you're able to answer.
On 38.
Yeah, this is not to the amendment, Mr. Chair.
We have the amendment before.
Why don't we, then I would recommend that we put your amendment on and then discuss an amendment to the bill as amended. All in favor of the author's amendment? Yeah, Representative Holder, I'm sorry.
On the amendment. Will you give me a kind of a definition of your any special academic services provided to a student and assure me that that's not the max structure exception to carry anything and everything about kids?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holder, the examples of special academic services would be gifted and talented programs, post-secondary education options, advanced placement, programs for students. It's those kinds of services that we're providing to students that are academic.
Commissioner Stevens, since you haven't formally introduced yourself for the record, do you mind doing that?
Just
so we have
a
clean record.
I am Commissioner Alice Segrin, the Department of Education.
Thank you. Representative Holberg, anything else?
No,
let's vote then on the author's amendment to get it in the shape that the author wishes it to be in. All in favor of the author's amendment, the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. So now to the bill as amended. Representative Mariani, you had a change.
Sure, very simple oral change on line 1.8 after the word done before department to insert Minnesota, and then on line 1.9 before the word office to insert the word Minnesota.
Okay. Is that anything you want to add or need to add? Okay. Well, then I guess I should move that amendment, right? So I will do so. Move that oral amendment. All in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No? Okay. The motion prevails. Okay. To the bill as amended, we'll go to the testifiers now. You just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Susan Higgott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. We're a cabinet agency about 4 years now. The office before was an independent agency, and then before that a coordinating board. We have a robust, substantial data system that involves enrollment information primarily from higher education. We publish an accountability report, and we really couldn't do that accountability report without this data that we get from public and private higher education institutions. I'm just going to give a little history, and then I'd ask Commissioner Segrin to finish up here, but this effort started as part of a P16 partnership work About 2 years ago, I was asked by Commissioner Segrin to head up a work group to try to figure out a way to establish a K-12 or P-12 student P-16 student identification number. We had a working group of stakeholders from higher ed and K-12. We met, as I said, for about almost 2 years. I think it took us quite a while to kind of work through the various steps, but we had public and private higher ed at the table. What we did is we worked through the data that we currently collect on the K-12 side. We worked through the data that we currently collect on the higher ed side, and we piece by piece decided what we would want to have be part of this particular system. So it was very selective. And then we looked at new data on each side that we'd be interested in collecting. And I think Commissioner Segrin alluded to ACT, SAT scores, the course curriculum that a student might have taken. And then we decided that we wouldn't create a new number or use a Social Security number, that the best thing to do would be to take the existing MARS number. And you know what that stands for, don't you? I don't remember. But the MARS number is assigned to students when they're in K-12 public education. So we decided we'd take an existing number and basically use that also on the higher education side. As I mentioned, we currently have a data system. The Department of Education currently has a data system. We're just asking for permission to share information with one another, and that would only be information and data in the aggregate, not individually identifiable information. We think it would be very helpful to try to improve our educational opportunities for students in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Eckhart. Commissioner Segrin.
I really don't have a whole lot more to add, except that some of you may not know what the P16 partnership is, and that is the heads of all of the higher education institutions, K-12, plus all the representatives of the education organizations, business representation, some foundations, Citizens League, and I think I said business. And it's a partnership where we come together voluntarily to look at things that we can do and implement that will make help our systems work together on behalf of improving education for kids. And so one of the things that we have been working on is how can we get enough information to know if our students, when they arrive in college, have had the right taken the right kind of courses, what would be the indicators of success for work or college. And right now, we don't have any way of following students once they leave our K-12 system for those colleges where kids would go in Minnesota. And so this will really provide us with a lot of really good information to say what happens when kids take, you know, a series of math courses or certain kinds of math courses or more science or is writing and technical reading and those kinds of things, skills that we need. So lots of different information that we can start to look at. We'll be able to see if students are getting through college on time. Right now we don't know what the percentage of students are that actually spend more than 2 years to get an AA degree, more than 4 years to get a bachelor's degree. So those are a number of other things. We also can look at students who are minority students to see what are their success rate. Even students, we have more students now that are going to college that have handicaps or who have special needs. We'll be able to, you know, see if accommodations are being made for them and the kind of support that they might need, and even for at-risk students. So we also... Oh, and then also in the legislation, FERPA, the federal law that actually governs what we can do with sharing data, we have had the Department of Administration review that to make sure that we're under the appropriate FERPA statutes, and they said that under this arrangement we will be. We also will be meeting all of the state data practices, procedures as far as providing a Tennyson warning for any time this data is collected. So we tried to cover all of our bases from that. And again, we want to assure you that we're collecting educational data only.
Commissioner Segrin, any questions from members on the committee? Representative Holder.
I do, Mr. Clare, and I appreciate that you came and talked to me about the bill. And we talked about the warning to the kids as they turn adults and getting an opt-in from them. And everything seemed fine, and now I'm reading the bill summary, and it said that the federal regulations provide that data may be disclosed without prior consent. for developing, validating. And so I'm a little concerned that I'm assuming the Code of Federal Regulations allows for that dissemination without consent.
Mr. Chair, and maybe I think we have the data privacy practices person here, but I think it's for sharing of research data, and that would be only within an institution of itself if you were looking at data. And
does anyone else? Is anyone here to testify on that particular issue, or can you answer that question?
This is going, I don't know, maybe to education or stuff, so maybe we can talk about some comfort language to make it clear. Right now, all it does is it references the federal statute that says you can collect a whole bunch of things without consent. That makes me a little uncomfortable.
Well, Representative Holbrook, that's a good point. I think from here it'll go to the full committee and then from there to education. So I think there'll be a couple stops at which we could work on this issue. Any other comments or questions from members? Anyone in the audience here who would testify for or against? Yes, ma'am. If you could state your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. EdWatch has concerns about the amount of data already collected on students and how it's shared and how it exists already. And I would just like to point out several things. First of all, the definition of student data or education data in 13.32 that is looking to be amended by this bill says that data, that educational data is, quote, individual.
Okay.
It includes, quote, data concerning immunizations, notations of special physical and mental problems, and records of school nurses are educational data, end quote, as well as family data, in quotes, and data on parents, in quotes. I understand that the intent is to limit the data to the things in this amendment, but the amendment itself says includes. It doesn't say must be limited to. It doesn't. So educational data could still be all the other things. And I would point out to this committee that there are bills floating around the legislature this session to monitor student body mass index, to do to continue genetic testing on babies and keep that data and not ask for consent, which could theoretically come as part of this. I would also point out to the legislature that a couple of years ago, the MARS data, the Minnesota Automated Recording Student System, which is the educational data number, was changed to include all kids when they go through the Minnesota preschool screening process, which means that data on children, including their preschool screening data, which includes all of the things that they screen on, including social and emotional data, is starting as young as 2 or 3 years old. So doing that MARS data without a really firm that it's limited to these isn't very comforting. And then on the last line of the amendment, it says any analysis or report of these data. It doesn't say the data to be exchanged must only be aggregate data. So, yes, you can do a report on it, but that doesn't mean that the data exchanged would be aggregate. It just means that the report is aggregate, the summary. And finally, Mr. Chairman and members, the state and the federal government has spent millions, if not billions, of dollars collecting data and doing studies of student performance and student education for decades. And we already know what works. Academic rigor, high expectations, intact families, those kinds of things. So we are just sort of at a loss to see how this would be all that helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Ruffin. Representative Mariano, you want to respond to that? I'm going to open up to everyone.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I'm just conferring with the commissioner, and she informs me that she's more than comfortable with language of the amendment on line 1.3 to strike include and insert must be limited to. I don't think that's an unreasonable request, and I think what the commissioners have both laid out here is precisely the kind of information that they're interested in.
So if I understand the proposed amendment, Representative Mariani, it would be on the language that's included on the A1 amendment, which is now part of the bill as amended, it would change line 1.3, it would delete the word include, and in its place would be the word must be limited to.
That's correct, that's true.
Well, I'll move that amendment. Any comments from members on the amendment before we vote on the amendment? Okay. All in favor of that oral amendment to the bill as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Okay. The motion is adopted. To the bill as amended, now the second time. Is there anyone else here who would wish to testify for or against the bill? Anyone in the audience? Dr. Ephraim? Sure. Go ahead.
I just going back to Representative Holberg's question a little bit ago about special academic services. Does this exclude special education as far as special academic services?
Mr. Chair and members, it would be our intent that special education designation would be included because we would want to see how many students would go to higher ed institutions, but it would not be getting into anything other than that. And special academic services would be, as I said, PSEO, gifted and talented services, etc. But we would not, again, we are limiting, we are not going to be collecting any kind of emotional behavior information, any kind of health information, any kind of immunization record information, no behavioral information, no discipline records, no suspensions, no expulsions, nothing that would be of a derogatory or negative nature for the students. This is just purely academic information.
Thank you, Commissioner. Dr. Ephraim, quickly, I think we're going to have to move on pretty quickly. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to be sure that I'm understanding that special academic services is only the designation and not the process of identifying them as such. Because I would point out to the committee and to the commissioner that 90% of special education is for learning disabilities, emotional behavioral disorders, or other health impairments that includes attention deficit disorder.
Commissioner Stevens, any response?
Madam Chair, it would just be whatever the special education designation of that student is.
Okay. Members, any other questions or comments on the bill as amended? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 3816 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Okay, the motion prevails. Pass to the next committee. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, the next bill. Now we're going to move on to putting together this year's Honor the Standard Practices bill. And members and those in the audience, the vehicle for this will be the technical bill, which is House File 3553. I also want to let you know that we've shortened the agenda here because there are two bills on the agenda that will not be heard. One is House File 3556. We are not going to hear House File 3556. And, okay.
I was looking forward to talking about it.
Okay, well, that's the only one we're lopping off right now. We may be lopping off a second one later. But I know people are restless, but we'll try to get through this. Since the vehicle bill is my bill, I'm going to vacate the chair now in favor of Representative Holberg, and it's for purpose of introducing the bill.
John, would you like to move your bill?
I will. I'll move. House File 3553 be recommended to pass and be sent to the House Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice.
Thank you. Would you like to continue?
Thank you, Representative Holberg. This is a technical bill. This is what we hope will be the vehicle for these other bills, which will be appended or not appended in vehicle in amendment form. And I'd like to just turn it over to Ms. Byer-Kropensky to introduce herself. Maybe spell her name. That might be that might be helpful. No offense.
Come up from time to time. Come up to
welcome. Welcome to the name. Ms. Byer-Kropensky, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Byer-Kropensky. LauriebeyerKropuen Mke.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Administration. And before you is House File 3553. And this may be the point where Representative Simon would like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is an A1 amendment. It should be in your packets. It's a quick, small, clarifying amendment. So I'll move the amendment.
All right. Would you like to explain, other than technical or?
Expensive.
Madam Chair and members, there was a reviser's error when it, as introduced. So we're just putting it back the way it should be, and then I'll talk about the entire bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, Section 1 of the bill deletes a reference to compiling, which is really an old-fashioned wooden machine that was around before there was a little tray at the end of the copier. We deleted a similar reference last year in 13.04, so we're doing the same deletion here. It doesn't have any impact at all on what can be charged for copies or anything else. We're just removing a reference to old technology for a lot of folks who don't even know what that was. Section 2 of the bill continues to do the change where we replace and use the government entity, the shorthand term for the longer one, statewide agency, political subdivision, and so on and so on. Section 3 makes a grammatical correction, just makes data plural, and the last change in Section 4 amends incorrect cross-reference in 260B.171 Peace Officer Records on Children. That was not caught when the section was recodified a number of years ago. And that's it. Purely technical in a very technical field.
All right, thank you. Any questions on the base technical bill? All right, and Chair Simon, I'll let you decide where you want to go from here. Which bill you want to take next? Or?
Sure. In terms of the bill to be taken up next, and here's where I need to provide information to many members and members of the public. Many of these bills are bills that you'll see I threw in the hopper, but even I have some problems with some of them, so I'll be asking tough questions of my own bill. So why don't we go with, in order, Madam Chair, with the amendment version of House File 3554. Members, and I get just a bit confusing here. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, you're saying that there's a DE amendment to 3554 in our packet, or?
No, not a DE amendment, but an amendment version of 3554 to be appended onto 3553. It basically is
3554 in amendment form.
So that you can
stick it on to 355.
I think we're going to call a friend here, and Mr. Gearing's going to explain what we're going to do. Mr. Gearing.
That's 37. Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, sorry. I think the process for putting together the omnibus bill would proceed most efficiently by taking up each of these bills as they are in the packets, and there are not formal amendments prepared for them just because it saves paper from having to recopy each of them. So each of the bills that will be heard to be amended to omnibus bill will hear the text of the bill as introduced, but they'll be treated for purposes of this hearing as an amendment to House File
3553. Thank you, Mr. Gearing. So, Representative Simon, if you want to move House File 3554 before the committee, and we'll...
I'll do that, Madam Chair, and I guess, and Mr. Gearing, tell me if this is the way we want to go. I'll move the text of it to serve as amendment form. Is that... I mean, I'm not really moving the bill itself as a standalone to go to the next level.
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, I think the motion would be to amend House File 3554 into House File 3553.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Simon, would you like to explain this bill?
Well, I think I could use some help myself, and I think I'll defer to the testifier on this bill.
Welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Mary Olson. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The purpose of this bill is really to make sure that we're clear here that the information on the driver's license application and the driver's license number is private. Whether we collect it in the Department of Public Safety or whether we provide it to other state agencies.
Members, are there any questions of this testifier on this bill? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify in support or opposition? It looks like Mr. Anchinson Representative Simon, did you?
Yes, good. And this is obviously fast moving with the subcommittee, but just before the hearing, I got word that there is an A1 amendment here that was proposed that I move on behalf of some folks who had some questions or maybe even problems with the bill. And at this time, if I could, Madam Chair, I'd like the person who suggested that I move this amendment, say one amendment, come up and testify as to why it is needed.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Olson. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Human Services, the Child Support Division. And the reason the amendment is being requested is that the bill as is prevents the child support agency from using information obtained from driver's license applications to establish, modify, or enforce child support obligations. Essentially, the bill allows the child support agency to get the data, however, they can't use it then as permitted by other statutes or as ordered by the court. So essentially, the amendment would allow data that the Department of Public Safety goes to other state or local agencies would allow them, for the child support agency or other state or local agencies, to then use that data. As indicated in the amendment, either according to a court order, according to a statute specifically authorizing disclosure of that data, or to administer federal funds or programs.
Representative Simon?
Madam Chair, as I said, I was handed this amendment, and I take on good faith the concerns that the department and others have. I guess I would just open up the amendment portion to others on the committee for questions, or maybe to other testifiers.
Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Ms. Allison, did you have any comments on the A1 amendment? Is this something that you support, or?
Madam Chair, Ms. Kennedy, we're neutral on this. It's our understanding that this...
But can you come to... I don't know how good a microphone we have here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, really the sole purpose of this, of the proposal that we're making is to really be clear about the privacy status of the information that we collect. It is our contention that what this bill does not change current practice. We're relying on the Department of Human Services that they feel that they have this amendment and that it's appropriate to administer their functions. It's certainly up to the committee to determine whether that is agreed. So we don't have any objections to their amendment.
Oh, and as I looked at it, I didn't see any substantive change. I'm not sure why the bill is here, actually, if it.
We have had some instances where we have provided driver's license information data to other state agencies, and there has been the assessment by other state agencies that the data within is not covered the same way it's covered within the Department of Public Safety. And we want to just make sure that that's clear.
And can you give me a specific example of that?
An example would be that we collect driver's license information and supply it to the Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources at some point was having discussions with us, feeling that the data, once we give it to them, since they're not a driver license function specifically, wouldn't be covered under federal law, which a federal law directs that state driver vehicle services agencies to treat that data as private. And the only uses that can be, the only way that that data can be used is for specific federally designated purposes. So anybody that we supply the data to, we have a user agreement. We ask them what they're using the data for. We make sure that it's covered by federal law and all of that. And because Chapter 13, Minnesota law doesn't classify the data as private, again, there are some instances where we provide the data to another state agency and they believe that they aren't covered under the same federal statute that we would be covered under. And so because there's been some questions and some confusion on the part of state agencies, we want to be very clear about that data. And again, we didn't feel that it changed any existing, could change any existing practice.
All right. I'm sorry, Representative DeLaForest.
Madam Chair, thank you. And perhaps a question for Human Service, not for the author, as I understand it. But if you look at on the A1 amendment on line 6, it talks about disclosing the data to simply administer federal funds and programs, which I would read to administer all federal funds in all programs. And so I'd like some clarification on that. I understand that there may or may not be a reason here. We're discussing it to reveal this data for a pretty legitimate purpose here for child enforcement support and the like. But what about language here that seems pretty broad to me that just says it may be disclosed to administer any funds or any program?
Ms. Olson?
I guess my question put narrowly is I understand the purpose as the witnesses articulated it before, but then why not narrow the language for that purpose?
What's your question for Ms. Olson from the Department of Human Services?
My question, Madam Chair, is always for anybody who can answer it. When we're doing data practices, I see Gemberling's here, and I'll call him up. Anybody who can answer it.
Simon?
Madam Chair, I think we have a solution on the fly.
Ms. Olson.
I understand the concern, and I thought it would suggest that the language should be amended in both line 1.6 and line 1.1 to state that to administer federal funds or programs for child support enforcement purposes.
I would move that oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Any questions about the oral amendment? To the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Well, I think, Mr. Emerson, was your discussion around the A1 amendment or the bill itself?
Both.
Okay, let's get your testimony before we adopt. Let's have a vote on the A1 amendment as amended. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. Mark Anthonson, again, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. The difficulty I have when I come before the committee on this bill is I don't know
what the bill may do. What the committee, subcommittee needs to understand is this plunges you into the chill, some of the chilliest waters in the statutory sea, in the sense that you're talking about dozens of hours of Senate and House committee time over the last 10 or 12 years, because you're dealing with the intersection between the Federal Drivers Privacy Protection Act, as it's been incorporated in the state statute over many sessions, and it's an incredibly convoluted, tortuous process that nobody understands. Representative DeLaForest threw the hanging curve out that maybe somebody was here who could answer the question. There are data practice questions I don't think anybody can answer.
Well,
I mean, when he sits, you know you've got an issue on the table. I can understand the purpose of the bill as articulated, but, I mean, I'm not sure that it works fully. Let me give you one quick example. You heard some testimony about what happens with this data that goes to other agencies. The DNR right now refuses to allow public access to any kind of licensing data, which previously had been all public, because in the last couple of years, that data is in part produced by tapping into public safety's motor vehicle and driver's license database, which in their council's view makes it subject to the Federal Drivers Privacy Protection Act, and therefore not public. Nothing state statute can maybe say about that helps. So I think we need to understand what we're doing. The other specific issue I have appears twice in the bill, on line 20 on page 1, and then again on line 20 on page 2. And as you can see, the current language says this data, the data specified, shall be disclosed. And the language change is to may. Again, I don't profess to know exactly what that means, but it could mean that it creates discretion to disclose this. Under current law, it must be disclosed if it's authorized. If disclosure is authorized, that's a big deal for a lot of people. And maybe that's not what that is intended to mean, but it sounds to me like a shift from mandating the disclosure, if it's permitted, to leaving the discretion to the agency, which would be a very significant change in law that, again, has been developed over 10 or 12 years. So that's, I wish I could shed more light, Madam Chair, but this is a fairly significant issue.
Thank you. Mr. Amundson, is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on House File 3554 or the A1 amendment? Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eric Highland. I'm with the law firm of Mesley and Kramer, and representing Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'd just like to put on the record, express some of the same concerns that Mr. Amundson has raised. This doesn't apply just to other state agencies. It also applies to all local government that has access to the driver's license information. And as many of you know, what happens in a squad car, all your information is on that card, and it is swiped into the system, and it populates a lot of different databases, many of which are public. And so we just want to make sure that we're being... I understand the department doesn't think that this is going to change current practice, and I guess I just want to put on the record that we're not convinced that this language actually does that, and we'll want to work with the author and the department to make sure that it's not causing any undue heartburn for folks.
Thanks. Any questions? Ms. Estevire. Anybody else? Mr. Gamberly. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and the record, please.
Will do. Madam Chair, my name is Don Gemberling. I'm a retired state employee who once spent all of his life doing this stuff, which in some people's minds mean I'm truly crazy. But it's interesting. It's not boring. The underlying problem, actually, we should blame on Charlie Weaver. Whom I consider an old friend, just so there's no problem. When the federal government, in its infinite wisdom, passed the totally misbegotten and misnamed Drivers Privacy Protection Act, which protects privacy hardly at all,
they required people like the Department of Safety, Public Safety, to have to follow what it says. And part of the problem with the Driver's Privacy Protection Act is it says driver's license information and motor vehicle information isn't public, but virtually everybody in the world who makes money off of it can have it. And if you think that's kind of weird, blame the federal government. That's not Charlie's problem. However, when Mr. Weaver was Commissioner of Public Safety, what he said was, we're going to treat this data as in a restricted status. Now, people like Representative Bielefors and Representative Holberg and other people know there's no classification of restricted status in the Data Practices Act. Now, when you built the Data Practices Act, you said government agencies have to do all kinds of stuff depending upon what kind of data they're hanging on to and how it's classified. So if you have a classification called restricted, then it doesn't link to any of the verbs in the Data Practices Act. Okay? So now, public safety has been, as I understand it, in practical terms, treating the data as if it were private. Okay? And I think what they're trying to do is to say clearly, that's what it is. Now, whether or not there are strange consequences that flow off that, such as that suggested by Mr. Hyland, I don't think so, but you may want to take a little time to think about it. But the underlying problem is, I'll give you an example. I had a person from public safety once tell me that because this data is not private, in Minnesota terms, maybe I didn't get to get a Tennyson warning.
Okay.
The notice required when private data is collected from an individual. Now, I don't think the department took that position, but I thought, oh, this is a real interesting argument. And can you make that argument if there's no specific classification for the data in the statute? Yeah, you can make that argument. The creativity of public lawyers is just without boundary, okay? Particularly when it involves curtailing public access and curtailing rights of subject to data. So to the extent that this at least advances rights of subject to data, I think what public safety is trying to do is probably a good idea. So, because it makes very clear what the classification of the data is. So your ability to say what can be done with the data after that is fine, except the Fed say you can't make it public. You just have to follow the rules that say that people selling cars, private detectives, anybody in the car parts business, and you know, 7 or 8 other exceptions can get access to the data, which of course means it's private. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Gamberling? All right, thank you. Representative Simon, we have the A1 as amended amendments in front of us at this point. And as author of the bill, if you'd like to provide some direction here.
Well, I think the motion would be that the amendment be passed as an amendment to 3553, which was
Mr. Chair, you're in support of the A1 amendment, then, as the author of the bill? All right. Any additional questions? Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the amendment would be to House Bill 3554. You haven't passed 3554.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes, Simon.
This would be the amendment to 3554, which we will later then offer, I guess, as an amendment to
3554. All right. Okay. All right. To the A1 amendment to House File 3554. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Now we have the House File 3554 as amended, and the motion would be then to amend this language onto the technical bill, which is House File 3553. And are there any additional questions on the particular bill in front of us? Representative DeLaForest, you look perplexed.
Madam Chair, I am frequently, but not right now. But I had a question after we adopt this. It's a procedural question, so I'll wait until we're finished with this item of business.
All right. Any other questions on House File 3554? Anybody else in the audience like to testify for or against? Seeing none, all those in favor of amending House File 3554 as amended to House File 3553, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Nay. The motion carries. All right. John Simon, your process here, so.
Hey, Madam Chair, if I might just have a procedural question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for the author. Representative Simon, I guess maybe I'll phrase this in a form of a comment, and you can reply. I know sometimes under both Republicans and under Democrats, when this gets to the full committee, we tend to sort of truncate discussion or debate and treat that as a formality. And I guess my hope would be certainly moving forward with this bill that we don't do that in the larger committee. I think that already, just being a little ways in the agenda, it seems we're going to have to take a couple bites at this, or at least I think we will need to on a bipartisan basis to get a good product that I think we owe the public and we owe ourselves to before we get to the floor. So I just hope that we do that in the larger committee. I just don't think we're going to get even to that 80% solution this evening here.
Madam Chair.
Representative West.
As the chair of the only other subcommittee to Representative Mueller's committee, I can assure you that we never take a truncated discussion on anything that comes out of subcommittee. So I don't anticipate that happening on this one either.
And Madam Chair, I would say
Representative
Simon. Seems just from the discussion here tonight to be an appetite for that discussion. So, I mean, in Chair Mueller's hands, but I think there will be naturally people want to say things.
Chair Simon, do you know if the Senate companion to the space bill was made for deadline or not?
I was told that things are on pace to be just fine deadline wise.
Or the Senate file to your the companion to your base bill. Okay. Let's hope that's the case. Which bill would you like to consider next as an amendment to your technical bill?
Madam Chair, I think House File 3555 would be the next one. This is a classified law enforcement agency hold data as private. I invite up the testifier or testifiers to introduce themselves for the record and talk about what they're about.
Chair Simon, are you aware of any amendments to this bill?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any amendments.
All right. So we have House File 3555 in front of the committee for possible consideration as an amendment to the base Omnibus Data Practices Bill. Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the testifier.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Letourneau-Lackner, L-A-C-K-N-E-R, and I'm a manager with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. This bill authorizes the BCA to hold data on individuals who are temporarily held in a law enforcement agency. For instance, if they are being transported to a different agency and need to be temporarily held in one agency, this data would be classified as private, which it currently is, and would only be released to criminal justice agencies or the data subject. The intent of the bill is to not allow those the whole data to be released for a background check because the whole data is not necessarily an arrest. It is just the fact that they're being held in that facility.
Representative Simon, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, Madam Chair, that's how I understand the bill as well.
And I do have some questions. So hold data, is there any time in which hold data would, is it where there would be an arrest before the hold? Is this only, we need to define hold for the committee because I'm not sure I understand that concept.
Madam Chair and members, hold data would be strictly when they are held temporarily in a facility, not for an arrest. If they're arrested, the arrest would appear as a different entry on the criminal history from the hold portion of data.
And if I might, somebody explain this as if you're actually physically moving prisoners from location to location. Is that a component of this as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Can you explain to me how you can move people around without arresting them? I'm just not understanding this process where you can drag somebody across the state if you haven't arrested them.
Madam Chair, there are instances where a person may be held in one facility and they're facing charges in another county, so they're transported to that other county until they can be seen in court in that county. So they're not necessarily under arrest in that specific jurisdiction. They're under arrest in another jurisdiction but are being held in that facility to appear in court. And in some instances, there are instances where somebody may be serving a sentence in a state correctional facility and they need to appear in family court for something. They'd be transported to that county's facilities while they're waiting to appear in court. But they're not in that facility for a criminal justice purpose.
And Representative West. So, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is where it gets a little strange. I'll be asking questions about what is nominally my bill. My question is, what about a custodial interrogation situation? Because this applies to any law enforcement. Is that considered being temporarily held so as not to be disclosed?
Ms. Wagner.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't believe that would be included in a custodial interrogation. The person is not likely booked into that facility.
Chair Simon. I'm getting more confused. I don't know about anybody else here. See if there's anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill. Mr. Neumeister. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rick Neumeister.
Let's take a look at what basically the language is saying. All data pertaining to an individual temporarily being held by a law enforcement agency. Right now, currently, they're treating it as booking data or arrest data at the BCA. The issue is that that data basically is private now. The issue is that they're trying to prevent that from becoming part of a background check. That's the purpose of the bill, what they're trying to do. So I think if that's what they want to do, that's what they should say. But on the other hand, that same kind of data is now public at the Department of Corrections through the statewide supervision, where that kind of data is already being publicly downloaded by a lot of third-party folks who are doing background checks.
Number three, that is also public on the local level, supposedly.
I mean, this language is only specifically to 1387. So if you're going to go forward with this type of amendment, it should say only to BCA, so there's no confusion that the local level will make it non-public, you know, the whole data.
My main point is the whole issue about
what are you trying to solve?
What I said with the memo that I shared with you and all the committee members is
a major principle that is very dear to liberty is that there are no secret arrests or holds. Arrest by general dictionary and some of the legal dictionaries I looked at this morning is arrest is defined as to seize a person by legal authority or warrant to catch and hold in custody of police or other authorities. I oppose this bill as is. If you're trying to make sure that for the 100 people or so that might be held, and it could be convicted people being held. What happened in Sherburne County just several months ago was someone, I believe it was from, was being transferred to a prison, and then someone else, a citizen, was brought into the same cell, and then I think there was a murder or something, I don't know for sure, but that person was there being held. I believe, if I remember right, unheld like a transfer to somewhere else. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think this is just one of those things my antenna goes up and I got some concerns of and how people may interpret it. They're trying to do what they want to do. I think it needs to be said differently. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Again, it's really unfair to Mr. Neumeister that you have him come up each time before me because I get paid to be here and he doesn't, and yet he's quite. I mean, I can just say I agree with Rich pretty much and get some of my point across. So,
Ms. Ramson, I think you could take him to lunch or something.
He did ask me to bring him over a sandwich tonight, and I forgot, to my undying shame. I have the same concerns Richard does, because anybody who works with the Data Practices Act over a course of time, as I have and many of you have, understands how critically important being very specific and very clear about the language is, or you'll get all kinds of unintended consequences and unanticipated interpretations of the language somewhere down the road. This bill applies to all law enforcement agencies in the state. What does it mean to temporarily hold somebody in custody? I mean, there are not only public access and accountability issues here, there are some serious civil liberties issues here. And I think, I understand what the department's trying to do, and I think it can be done right. But this absolutely, this language here invites all sorts of mischief and debates and arguments. What's temporary? How long? It's in direct conflict with the current statute governing arrest data, and Richard cited the dictionary definition of arrest data, but the Data Practices Act definition is better. Following data collected by law enforcement to substantially deprive an adult individual of liberty for any period of time. I mean, does this override that? Does it correlate somehow with it? I don't think, as a matter of policy, we want to be adopting a statute that says law enforcement doesn't have to disclose who they're holding temporarily, unless we're very careful about how we define the context and who it applies to and what data, or you're inviting serious issues. So I think it can be fixed, but I think in its present form, it's awkward. Thank you, madam.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson? No? Okay, thank you. Representative DeLaForest.
I did have a question maybe for the author. Again, it's data practices, so I'll pose it to the body. So the consent for release of information from the individual is not effective, and I'm just wondering why an individual is denied the right to release the data or to sign a waiver or a release form.
Wagner. Just state your name again for the
Madam Chair. My name is Julie Letourneau-Eckner, Representative DeLaForest. The reason we put that language in there is to prevent that information from going out on a background check. And again, the reason for that is oftentimes the hold information has nothing to do with a criminal event, and so we didn't feel it was appropriate to release that information on a criminal background check.
Representative DeLaForest.
Perhaps I'm not reading the bill or the amendment, as it were, correctly, but, you know, hypothetically, suppose I wanted to have the data released and I signed a waiver. In reading this, it appears that that wouldn't be effective. If someone showed up and said, hey, I've got a waiver from DeLaForest here, I want the information about when he was held by law enforcement, it sounds like under this bill that would be denied. You'd say that's not effective. Is that true?
Ms. Lackner.
Madam Chair, Representative DeLaForest, that is true.
Yes, I'm troubled when individuals aren't even allowed to waive that information. But again, I think as Mr. Anfinson noted here, this bill's got all sorts of potential for mischief. I mean, perhaps I am being temporarily held by law enforcement, and I meet with my attorney, for example, and I want the world to know that I'm being held. I want the world to have the data. You're holding me, and I want the world to know, and I can't even consent to that. So it's, perhaps we're piling on a little bit, but I think that the language certainly needs to be tightened up to meet the more narrowly stated purpose.
Ms. Lassner, I thought you had a comment.
Madam Chair, I was just going to clarify that the information would still be available from the local law enforcement agency. This would just apply to the data that's held by the BCA.
Can you tell us where it makes that clarification in the bill?
It isn't in this subdivision. It is 1387 applies to criminal history data that is held by the BCA, or criminal justice data.
And if I might, then why did you choose the language being held by a law enforcement agency instead of the BCA in writing your bill?
Madam Chair, that is in relation to the data subject. The individual is being held, not the data, by the law enforcement agency.
But I guess the question I'm asking is if you only wanted to put this standard within the BCA and not at a local level, why didn't you state that an individual temporarily being held by the BCA?
Madam Chair, the individual would temporarily be held by the law enforcement agency. It's the data that's held by the BCA. And if that isn't clear...
No, I guess I was reading it wrong in that I thought you were talking about only individuals being held by the BCA as opposed to being held by local law enforcement, not the data itself, I guess, was the differentiation I thought you were making, but I was misunderstanding.
Well, Madam Chair, perhaps there have been subsequent rulings from the Department Administration alike, but 1387 also includes data disseminated through the criminal justice information system. It isn't merely that which is held or created by BCA. It's also the information that's disseminated through the system as well. But I think make the point that the language is vague in many respects here.
Simon?
I guess I was wondering, too, whether this would apply, this temporary hold, could this apply possibly to someone who is, for example, intoxicated and held, brought to sort of a detox facility overnight by law enforcement? Would it apply to that as well?
Ms. Lackner.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, if the individual is temporarily held in detox, they, again, are not likely to be booked. They're held in detox until they can go through the booking process. They would report to the jail and be booked and arrested at that point, and it would appear on the record as an arrest.
Simon.
Well, I guess I would say this generally speaking. I understand and sympathize with the idea that we don't necessarily want, as part of a background check, the fact that someone is held before they're even arrested. And there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, what should or shouldn't be discoverable by private vendors when it comes to background checks. What about, for example, arrests that don't result in a conviction? What about an arrest that doesn't even result in a charge, ultimately? I understand that. This is even before that. I mean, I understand the impulse behind this, as Ms. Lackner talks about it, which is that we don't want someone merely being held to show up on their job application, or they apply for a job and then someone does a background check on them and says, you were once held for this. Not arrested, not charged with, not convicted, but you were merely held for something. I understand that. I guess the problem I'm having is whether this language really gets there. And I guess I'm not understanding yet, based on all the explanation, how it necessarily does. And so what I'm wondering and suggesting, Madam Chair, is rather than speaking of opt-in and opt-out, rather than just put this in the bill and go to the and fix it later, I would actually urge us not to put it in the bill, and then later on, if the department suggests to me or to others an amendment when we go through the full committee, then maybe we can put it in there. But I guess I'm personally uncomfortable, since it's my name on it, after all. It doesn't mean I won't speak again for other things with my name on it, but I'm really, at this point, uncomfortable with the language. I think many members here have brought up several questions that need answering before I'm comfortable, even as a placeholder, putting it in. So I would personally urge us... I could withdraw the amendment.
Right, the House File 3555 amendment as amended.
Yes.
You want to withdraw that from consideration of the committee at this time.
Yes.
With the caveat of all those here that it may reappear in another form.
Correct.
When we're before Chair Mullery's committee.
Correct.
Any other testimony on House File 3555? All right. We'll set that aside. And where would you like to go next?
Why don't we go with House File 3701, please?
Members will take up House File 3701 as a possible amendment to House File 3553. And are there any amendments to 3701? I'm told that there's a technical, we need to do an oral amendment on line 11, Mr. Geary.
Madam Chair, just a technical amendment on line 11 of House Bill 3701, after the word or, insert if.
Mr. Gehring, are we deleting or?
No, after the word or, insert if. So it would read, or if a statute specifically provides a different classification.
Would you like to incorporate that, Representative Simon?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Sure, I'll hand it over to Ms. Lackner to describe this one as well.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee again, Ms. Lackner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill basically classifies data on individuals who undergo background checks as private data. When we get a consent form, currently we do not maintain that consent form on file. In the future, we will be maintaining that informed consent and the data that is part of that consent, which can include the individual's name, any former married names, maiden names, dates of birth, address, and that type of information. And we just wanted to get this in place to protect those individuals in case someone came to us and requested copies of that informed consent.
Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question about the bill. I don't think that on line 1.9, at least I haven't been made aware of it, is background check data a defined term under the Data Practices Act? And if not, what I'm concerned about is that that's pretty broad. I don't know, if it's not a defined term, I don't know what that means. Background check data could mean almost anything, but maybe you'll tell me it is a defined term.
Ms. Lackner.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, it is not a defined term.
Ms. Lackner, I have a question for you. If, in fact, what you're trying to maintain as private is the actual consent form for the background check, then why wouldn't you have just said that in your bill?
I worked with the revisor's office, and this is the language that they came up with.
I mean, I'm reading this, and it's pretty broad. And given that the DCA does a number of background checks, it might be construed that any of the data that was involved in a background check would then have this classification. And if what you're really trying to do is shield the consent form of the data subject to conduct the background check, then I think maybe if you say that, and I don't know if we're going to have testimony against this bill or not, I'm just... I'm anticipating we may. We got Mr. Neumeister raising his hand for one page at least. So are there any questions on the bill as it sits right now from committee members? All right, let's see if there's additional testimony and go from there. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister for the record. This is the governor's proposed reason for this bill. The BCA conducts criminal history background checks on individuals for various purposes. The name and dates of birth, as well as the requester data, are maintained in our records for data subjects on whom the background checks were requested, along with the data that they provide. This data is maintained for up to 2 years for administrative purposes. Because the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act assumes data to be public unless specifically classified, we are requesting that this data be classified as private. Madam Chair, I oppose this bill. And I'll share with you, basically, for the record, the reason why. Over the last two decades, a number of you and I have seen 20, 30 background check statutes done. Statutes in where hundreds of thousands of people now are getting background checks. These thousands of people work with our children, grandmothers, loved ones, etc. Should not the parents or the sons and daughters be able to find out if a background check was properly done or even done at all by the entity or business who said they have done a background check?
I believe the answer is yes. What's happening now, and we see it in the public and all that,
a lot of folks are saying, oh, background checks are done, this or that. And then what happens down the line?
You find out maybe a partial one was done, or maybe none done at all. And one of the things I think is very important for
government accountability and public accountability, even in terms of those groups that say that background checks are done. And the only way that can be done is where currently under law, if, like for example, I work for Metro Mobility. There's a background check that's supposed to be done on me. If people are saying that Rich Neumeister has had a background check done, but let's say some customers want to know, because whatever Neumeister's doing or whatever, I want to find out.
A little weird sometimes.
I want to find out about Rich Neumeister has a background check done. Okay. They on their own can go to the BCA and find out if there has one done. I'm just trying to illustrate that as an example from the many ways background checks are done. Maybe that it's an issue down the line, but I don't know. I don't see where I try to balance the right to know versus the right to privacy, and I don't know on the right to know issue on this one.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my response to that, although I do have a problem with the first part of the bill about what is background check data, it seems broad, particularly because it's not a defined term in the statute. That's the problem I have. I have less of a problem, Mr. Neumeister, with what you said, because a person in the circumstance that you just described could go to Metro Mobility and find out and seek information from it to see whether it complied, as it said it did, with the background check statute, whether it saw. So, you know, the person trying to seek that information wouldn't necessarily have to go to BCA. They could go to the requesting source, at least if it's a public entity, they could. And in your example, it was.
Mr. Neumeister?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feynman, they could go to the Metro Mobility, but you've got to remember background checks are not just done under statutory background checks. A lot of BCA checks are just done just generally by a lot of private entities who are just doing regular criminal justice background checks on their own.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anybody else in the audience? Mr. Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Just state your name for the record, please.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Members, Mark Anthonson, again, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Most of the concerns that I, as previously, would have expressed on this bill have already been articulated in an eloquent fashion. So I, just for the record, want to reiterate the point that Representative Simon has himself made. The scope of that first sentence, and the chair also called attention to that, is very sweeping. And I will guarantee you again what's going to happen if it's adopted in that fashion. Somewhere down the road, someone will say that anything in a background check in other agencies, other places, somehow is not accessible. And if the expressed reason for the bill is as it is, then I think there's a simple way to avoid that sort of unintended result. So, thank you.
Representative Simon.
Chair, I don't want to short-circuit any other testimony. My preference would be on this bill, and I can just do it, I guess, by saying it. My preference would be, again, to, at this point, withdraw the amendment for some of the reasons that have been talked about. And by the way, I just want to say on the record, this is not meant as a slight to Ms. Lackner or her agency, who I'm sure has worked very diligently under tough circumstances and very tight deadlines. This has all been on the fly, and some of these bills are just coming out. So I mean no disrespect. It's just that I'd rather err on the side of not putting something in with as big a loophole for now, knowing that there will be other opportunities later to insert it. So with that, unless there's any other testifiers for or against, I would withdraw my motion on the amendment.
If there are any other individuals in the room that have concerns about House Bill 3701 or the previous bill, make sure that you take the time to contact Representative Simon soon so as he's trying to address or work on solutions. That he will have your input prior to Representative Mullery's committee. He likes to move a little faster. And with that, House File 3701 is withdrawn.
Madam Chair, that leaves, I think, by my count, only one actual bill that's on the agenda as being ready, although there is one other amendment. Oh, no, I'm sorry. My XXX bill will be after this, so there are two left. The next one, I guess, would be House File 3787 regarding civil investigative and licensing data. I'll turn it over to Ms. Bartopensky.
Thank you. All right, and I see we have a DE, an A1 amendment that's a delete all amendment. Would you like to move that to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to consider it?
I'll move the A1
amendment. All right, members, Representative Simon has moved the A1 amendment to House File 3787 to get the bill in which he'd like to discuss it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I'll just turn it over to the testifier.
All right, Ms. Byers-Kopinski.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Byers-Kopinski with the Department of Administration. When I came to admin in 2004, I had a really simple mission. I wanted to proactively change the Data Practices Act so really that anyone who picks it up, citizen, government, could read it, understand it, and use it. I thought it was a pretty simple thing, and I thought I'd achieve it in, you know, a couple months. So it's going to take a little bit longer, I acknowledge that. But the bill in front of you works to clarify two sections that have been particularly problematic, civil investigative data and licensing data. The public law section of the SAFR has a data practice committee of state and local government attorneys, and over the years that I've been attending, I heard lots of people talking about how hard it was to try and reconcile these two competing provisions and to brainstorm how different people did it differently. They really were looking for someone to kind of take on the challenge of bringing changes forward to the legislature. So my staff and I also get calls and questions consistently from our customers on how to interact with these two sections. With all these folks, both on the citizen side and the government side, struggling with these provisions, I asked a small group of government attorneys to work on a draft that would clarify this language between these two sections. And since these sections have been passed in 1982, both passed in the same year, there has been a lot of case law around these sections, as well as a lot of Commissioner of Administration advisory opinions interpreting them. To me, what that means is the sections aren't as clear as they need to be. So the bill, as you see it, well, it looks completely different. It's a scaled-back version, but it was introduced late in the Senate last year to really give people a lot of time to give feedback. Since the whole goal was to provide clarity, I've been, you know, kind of just asking people, really, tell me anything that this, you know, fixes that wasn't broken in the first place. We wanted to hear lots of feedback from people, and we have had that. The changes you see really reflect stakeholders from the Newspaper Association to the League of Minnesota Cities to AMC, Education Minnesota, state agencies, County Attorney Association, legal aid. It also, the A1 reflects substantial changes based on the feedback from the Senate Data Practice Committee last week. I've been working to incorporate everyone's feedback, but let me walk you through the bill, the A1 amendment quickly, and then answer any questions that you might have.
All right, thank you.
Section 1, Madam Chair, of the bill amends the definition of civil investigative data to include both data collected, which is what it currently says, and created. So the created data is something new. And also provides an exception for the notice of claims that was at the request of Mr. Anthonson. Section 2 of the bill deletes language that is already incorporated in Section 1. It adds that addition of creation of data. We also continue to do that shorthand change for government entity that we continue to do throughout the Act. And one of the big policy changes here is that it extends the authority for data that's called civil investigative data to allow the government entity the discretion to be able to share it when they need to aid the investigative process or to allow for the exercise of due process. Right now, once data is civil investigative data, even if it's about me, so if I'm being investigated for something, even though it's about me, I can't get it because it's confidential data. This would allow at some point when they want to interview people about what I might have done, allows them to share data so that they can actually investigate it. They can't just say, were you doing something last week? Or, how about, I think I saw Lori hit her coworker. They really need to be able to share data to do an adequate investigation. And at some point, they need to share data with me so that I can defend myself. So at some point, we want the Data Practices Act to have an explicit reference that says it's okay to share data at some point so that someone can defend themselves. Because right now, the only vehicle for that person is to go to court to say, I think you need to share this with me. We also limit the sharing that the government entity is given so that if it's subject to a protective order by the court or the ALJ, of course, you're going to have to follow a court order. We like to see that. Section 3 just makes a grammatical correction. Section 4 adds a new subdivision for which allows that any data that becomes a part of a court record or an Office of Administrative Proceeding is public data, with the exception of any protective orders the court might order, court rules, or other laws. So I go through and there's an investigation, and then we go off to OAH, and at some point there might be the identity of the person who complained about me. That might be data that's private. My Social Security number might be in there, and they're going to reject that too. So this just allows that anything that goes with public, but then you're going to wind up redacting pieces that, you know, you're not going to make someone's Social Security number public regardless of where it appears. Section 5 of the bill is where we get to the changes to the licensing data section. We add a definition that really tries to narrow the scope of a license to really be those licenses that you must have to perform a profession, and excludes other things that a state agency might do, like my recreational fishing license. I'm an attorney. I don't need a fishing license to be an attorney, but we don't want people to be confused about what kind of licenses are public and which kinds are private. These are really just the ones you need, like a teacher. You can't teach unless you have a license. These are the kinds of licenses we want to talk about and have the definition tightly wrapped around. We also clarify that this section only applies to state agency licensing, which, Madam Chair, you know is a defined term. State agency means any board, commission of the state. The current language, even though it says the same thing, has been often misinterpreted by local governments as covering their kinds of licensing, liquor licensing, and it's not supposed to. We want it to be crystal clear so that normal people can understand and use this and don't have to kind of look to advisory opinions and various things. Section 6 of the bill adds additional data elements that are going to be public about an applicant for a license. So right now, the only thing that's public about me when I'm an applicant is my name and my designated address. This would extend that so that there's additional things. You can say whether or not my application's pending, whether or not it's been withdrawn, whether or not it's been revoked. So there's additional elements that you can then make public. We also add a reference to 1339, which is your civil investigative data, and this is where you start to see these two sections work together, that once civil investigation is done, there is already a provision that allows for the identity of an unsubstantiated complaint to be private data when no discipline is imposed. So we just make it clear that it goes from first it's licensing data, then there's a claim that you've done something wrong, then it becomes civil investigative data. When that course is run, it comes back, and then some elements are still going to be private. Some are going to be public when it's done. Depends. And then we delete language related to inactive investigations that's already in 1339. Section 7 adds language that is repealed in Subdivision 5 for the post board and just kind of moves all the post board stuff all together. Section 8 of the bill amends the authority to share private data from the current standard, which is clear and present danger to public health or safety, and makes it nearer what's already in 1339, which allows the disclosure to aid law enforcement, the investigative process, and to allow for exercise of due process rights, and also deletes the reference to confidential data, because now all the confidential data is going to be sitting in 1339, not 1341. Section 9 adds a new section to 1341, which basically says all investigations of licensees are going to be handled under civil investigative data. Section 10 is the repealer, which repeals the subdivision about confidential data in 1341, and then also repeals Subdivision 5, which was a partial restatement of the general presumption that all data is public. And what we keep seeing is every time there is some kind of a partial restatement of the presumption, people think that's all that's public. So what we just want to do is be really clear about what data is private so that people don't need a list of, and by the way, we meant that all these things were public, because then people think, oh, that's it. and then it causes confusion. So what we try and do here is just be clear about what is private data and repeal all of the references to what data is public, because it's already public, that and more under the presumption of our act. So that is the overview of the bill, Madam Chair, if there are questions from members or from you.
Right. Thank you very much. Any questions from Ms. Byers-Rupinski at this time?
Madam Chair, you didn't ask Mr. Neumeister to spell his name, and I think that's almost as hard as mine. Just, you know, and Lackner also hard.
Okay. My apologies. Is there anybody that would like to testify to House File 3787? Oh, we got all kinds of... Mr. Anthonson? Mr. Anthonson, I'm going to let you go first so that you earn your keep rather than Mr. Neumeister going ahead of you. And he can get up and say that he agrees with you.
Madam Chair, members, Mark Anthonson, an attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. It hurts me to tell you that this is the one bill on the agenda tonight where Mr. Neumeister and I don't agree. Kidding. We have similar concerns, but I don't have much to say because, first of all, I want to commend Ms. Byers-Rupinski and the author for attempting to clarify one of the most problematic portions of the Data Privacy Act historically. There's portions of this section that just really aren't very comprehensible, and it's worth the effort to try and improve them. And she's the audacity of hope, a term that has been used by some politicians. I think this is an audacious and hopeful project, and I hope she succeeds. I don't think it's quite there yet. But this is better than the Senate version. The Senate committee spent 2 hours on the other night. And
I'm
going to
do that.
I want to hear that again.
Mr. Anthonson, could you maybe briefly point out where your concerns lie with the A1 amendment?
Part of my problem, Madam Chair, is that I almost called you, Your Honor. That would be bad. I only saw this an hour or so ago for the first time. I can't be sure. I can tell you it's an improvement. I can also tell you, and I think this is an important context for this bill, it involves two of the most important sections of the entire statute. Civil investigative data, licensing data, collectively encompass a gigantic array of government records that are often very important to the public. And so care needs to be taken to do this right. But we'll work with the author. Again, I wish I could be very specific about what concerns me. I just haven't had time to digest it. It's very important stuff, and I think it will continue to evolve in the right direction. So.
And I see the time stamp. I'm looking at this now, so I can understand that. And I think that, well, Representative Simon, I respect where you are with this process. I'm really hopeful that the Senate companion to this is made deadline, because I think some of this stuff's going to take some time. And while Representative Mullery likes to spend a lot of time on certain things, I can't imagine he's going to want to spend a whole committee hearing on these particular issues. So I think it's going to take a pretty extraordinary effort of a lot of emails and memos back and forth and keeping the committee members informed of where this stuff's going in order that we can get all the concerns addressed. And again, the committee members just have seen these at last minute as well. So, Representative Simon?
When you look at the date stamp, so for the record, it's 2:11 p.m. This hearing started at 6 o'clock, and I don't blame anyone for that. This is very fast moving, and all of us are being caught with stuff coming in at the last minute, particularly since it's deadline week. But my understanding is, and someone who was at the hearing could correct me, that the Senate has actually tabled the companion bill. So that presents some problems for us. I do think it's important that we air these issues, and I'd like to hear from testifiers for and against. But that's something that does concern me. I haven't had a chance to talk with Ms. Byers-Rupinski about that. I'm not meaning to ambush her or her agency with this, but I do have concerns about that. It's important that we put it on the calendar and that we air these in the House as well. But I don't know, frankly, I'm just telling you right now, whether this is worth proceeding with at this point until we really have all the stakeholders on board. I didn't see this amendment until right before the hearing either, and that's nobody's fault. That's absolutely appropriate. But things are so fast moving, and we are making really big changes. I think we ought to be
wary of going too quickly, but I'm interested in hearing what other folks have to say.
And we had a number of people raise their hands, so I think we have plenty of testimony. If you'd like to step to the table and state your name for the record, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. And I wanted to thank Ms. Sire Kopensky also. We've been discussing with her over the last probably week or so our concerns with the bill, and she's been receptive to talking with us about them. Essentially, really what our concern boils down to is the issues of when the data is shared and who decides what gets shared. And essentially, a lot of this boils around the intersection of the new definition of civil investigative data and the word pending civil legal action, because that word, as it's now blended in, creates some confusion. Our concern is that when this is read all together, it could be interpreted that when someone brings an action against you, it is only the records that are part of the court record or OAH file are public. The others are arguably at the discretion of the state agency, who is the person who is suing you. So your ability to come out and get that information from the agency is left to their discretion, unless the really hinges on words like the pending legal action, the commencement and the defense of an action. It really muddies the water of what happens before there's an action started and what happens after an action is started. And so our concern is making sure that that line is distinct so that people are aware that once an action is started, you should be able to get the data that an agency used to bring an action against you. And that's essentially where our concern lies. Thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, I can see why the Senate spent 2 hours on it the other night. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Krisnick. I'm a staff attorney with Education Minnesota. Krisnick is K-R-I-S-N-I-K. I think we share the comments of the previous testifiers that we want to commend the department for trying to clarify the law, and we recognize why that's a challenge. We have one real specific concern, and currently civil investigative data is classified as civil investigative data when the chief attorney for the governing body determines that a civil action is pending. And we've had experiences where our members have tried to get data on themselves, data that government maintains, and the attorneys have said they will not release that data because someday, sometime within a 6-year statute of limitations, they may be sued. And so we share the concern that was just expressed about needing a definition of what a pending civil action is. Is the mere possibility, no matter how remote, a pending litigation lawsuit? We don't believe so. So we think in addressing that, either we'd need to clarify exactly what pending means, or at a minimum, we need to say that the chief attorney for the governing body needs to have some reasonable likelihood of believing that civil action is pending. And we, like others, are very willing to work with the author and work with the other stakeholders and try and reach a solution. But as written, we have some concerns about that provision of the bill.
All right, thank you. Any questions to the testifier? All right, thank you very much. Anybody else? Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Michaels, M-I-C-H-E-L-S. Madam Chair, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be heard on this. I'm a labor attorney in Minneapolis, and I represent a number of public safety employee unions, which include the Police Officers Federations of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And in fact, I also represent the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association, which is the umbrella organization that represents your state troopers, BCA agents, and conservation officers. I'm here, I agree with everything that's been said by the prior speakers on the bill. I do a lot of work with the Data Practices Act, obviously, in the course and scope of representing the employees, public employees. And I think the majority of what's done in this bill is very favorable. There are two aspects, however, that at least my police officer clients have concerns about. And they relate to the general policy that the legislature has had since the act was first adopted, which in fact is even incorporated in some of the aspects of this bill, which preserves the privacy of data about an employee against whom a complaint is made until after there's been a determination that discipline should be imposed and the appeal rights of that employee have run their course. The two aspects of the bill that I'm concerned about that appear to have the potential to change that relationship and to allow for the disclosure of data prior to a final determination of discipline are the provisions in lines 4.13 to 4.16, which relate to the release of data for licensing agency. This is the so-called public safety exemption. It's changing the threshold that's currently in the law from one that is the failure to release would create a clear and present danger to one in which the access will aid the public safety exception. Now, it was referenced that this adopts the same language that's in section 13.39. However, that reference in 13.39 is when a motion has been made to a court for a court order to release the data. And so there would be the discretion of the judge interpreting the statute as to whether this public safety exception has been held, rather than what this proposes would be to allow the discretion in the agency. And I'm concerned that under certain circumstances, especially with sometimes complaints against police officers, can have the potential for a lot of public concern, legitimate or not, to be raised, that you might get an agency that under this new language might release data that before the determination of wrongdoing by the officer, when under the present language of the statute, it might not do that. The other concern relates to lines 2.21 to 2.25 that include the Office of Administrative Hearings. Occasionally, the Office of Administrative Hearings is engaged by the employer and the employee to hear disputes as to whether the appropriateness of discipline should be upheld. So you can have circumstances there as well where now all of a sudden, if evidence that's being introduced into the hearing process becomes public upon its introduction, it may be then public and subject to release before the ALJ has made the determination that the accused employee has in fact done something wrong. We'd be perfectly happy to work with the author if the bill moves forward to try and deal with these, because as I said, the bulk of the changes here I think are good, and many of them would be supported by the police officers I represent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Any questions? Thank you. Anybody else in the audience like to testify? Mr. Gamberling. I'm sorry, Ms. Michael, did you have something you wanted to add?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
You bet. Don Gamberling, just like it sounds. trying to think of where to start. I think it's important that somebody say real plainly, the biggest problem with section 1339 is best described as follows. It's the black hole of the DAC license. Okay.
Now what do I mean by that?
If you want to really hide something, you go to your attorney and you say, might we get sued about this sometime?
Sometime.
And if so, can you declare the civil investigative data? And if your attorney says yes, then that data becomes not public until one of the conditions that's in 1339 occurs. I understand what the department is trying to do here, but I think it doesn't address that problem. In the years that I worked with this section, I cannot tell you how many times what I said a couple of minutes ago actually happened. Okay? It was very common for an attorney to say to me, we're trying to keep this data not public or not accessible to the individual subject of the data, but we can't find a section that classifies the data as private or confidential. What can we do? I said, well, you know, you go back to the presumption that it's public. And then the statement we made, well, you know, we could always put it under 1339. Okay. So I think
in a session that's not a short session,
At some point, you've got to take a serious look at the abuse that occurs with this language.
Okay?
Because what's evolved is what we used to call the data practices non-disclosure mantra. If you've got some stuff you don't want to have public, or in the case of Mr. Michael's clients, you don't want a data subject to get, you say, well, first of all, it's Section 1339 data. And then you fight about that, whether or not the data fits the definition. If that fails, then you say, well, it's attorney's data, which is another section under the Data Practices Act that keeps the public and data subjects from getting access. If the attorney's data section doesn't work, then you go to the kind of the atomic bomb of non-disclosure, which is you call it attorney-client privilege. Okay? Which, if there aren't a lot of people who understand the Data Practices Act, there are even fewer people who really understand the depth of the law about attorney-client privilege. I had occasion a few months ago to spend several hours looking at attorney-client privilege, which gave me a very large headache. So at some point, I think you really need to look closely at how you stop that kind of abuse.
Okay?
Because it is abuse. Because I don't think that's what you ever intended with this section. Now, another question I have is, I heard the list of people who've been consulted about this section. What I didn't hear is the agency that brought this section forward in the first place. That's the Attorney General's office. Okay? They didn't testify in the Senate. I have no idea where they are on this. And I think the chief law enforcement officer of the state of Minnesota ought to be on record, because this section was primarily drafted by the Attorney General's office back in 1981, because I worked with them. Okay? So, I think you got to say, is this making things better? And I think some of it is, but not completely. Part of the problem is, and maybe I'll get Mr. Anthonson agreed with this, some of the case law is really strange. Okay? It's like the Supreme Court struggles with this stuff.
Okay?
He had a wonderful case, the St. Peter Harrell case, in which the Supreme Court based almost the entire case on the idea that a notice of claim wasn't something that the city collected.
Okay?
And it seems to me that kind of parsing is not just, it's just not good policy. So I'd urge you at some point to look at that. Now, the licensing section, and then I'll shut up. What the intent appears to be is to take a bunch of stuff that you've clearly said is public, and that's not in the bill, it's in the licensing section, it's 1341 subdivision 5, and now move the treatment of that kind of data when you want to make it public into 1339. I think that's what the intent is. But what I don't really understand is whether or not that preserves everything that's in Subdivision 5, 1341, and keeps it public, okay? Because there are all kinds of reasons why that list was developed in 1341, Subdivision 5, to keep it public. And I can think of a couple of instances where you're going to end up with less data public than you have now, if you treat it only under Section 1339. Give you an example.
In the list of data that's currently public, you have
conclusions of law,
specification of final disciplinary action, and a record of a licensing disciplinary action are public in those instances where there's a public hearing concerning the disciplinary action.
Well, that says we're tying that data to the fact that there was a public hearing. Okay? In the new way of treating it, where does that fall then? Okay? And you end up having to come back here later on and come up with some more language to make that kind of accommodation. So, and I'm just not sure whether or not you end up with less public
than what you have now. Okay.
Because, again, a section that was worked on real hard several years ago. So, that's all the comments I have. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. I have one question, one suggestion. I heard a new concept. I've never been able to understand what by request means. Nominal offer. You got to try that. You got to have a rule on what a nominal offer is. That sounds like a really good thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Gamberlin? All right, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister.
Also, I do have a pass out. I have a 13.
What the 1341 statute is?
Someone just like to
pass out the
request. Madam Chair, members of the committee,
I this is the granddaddy of all data practice bills this year. And it's been narrowed down a little bit, but still there's a fair amount of problems
with it.
I still continue to oppose the bill as is, and I will share some of those concepts and points.
First of all, I want to share with you, these are all the commissioner's opinions in court cases on 1339 and 1341. Some precedent, some opinion, telling public entities, you know, what to do with how to interpret 1339, how to deal with 1341. One of the concerns I have is if we monkey around with this language, you know, since 1994, there's been suggested by the commissioner's opinion a working definition of civil investigative data, and which is civil investigative data are either data collected by an entity subject to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act as part of an active investigation that was undertaken for the purpose of the commitment or defense of a pending civil legal action, which is different than what is being defined here. I contend, at least, I think it's a lowering of the standard where what, if this proposal goes through, you know, a person, the chief attorney will be able to say, well, you know, there may be some type of civil action or whatever, so we'll want to keep it non-public. You've got to remember, it's not just employees type issues. It's investigative data can be all kinds of things, dealing with housing, a liquor investigation, you know, a liquor license investigation, whatever, a complaint or whatever it might be. I think one of the things that can happen is to find the word pending, at least with the dictionaries that I've dealt with, they define it as something that's imminent or awaiting. By this proposed definition, but I think what is happening here, there will be less public data available than there is now. Now, I think also, as has already been talked about, is that some of the language could say that should be public. Someone wants to get access to public. And a lot of these opinions deal, several of them deal with individuals who are trying to get access about themselves. And then they go to the commissioner for an opinion. I think that with this standard here, some of the data will be able to be pigeonholed much easier. The other point that I share with you is if you take a look at the 1341 language, subdivision 5, which was handed out, you'll see the whole kinds of stuff of public data that is now publicly available under licensing. So the nexus is, when it comes under 1339, how has this changed? Now also, if you go back to the bill, one of the concerns that I have is the language that says that a court order can be issued by an administrative law judge to make things non-public. I don't know if currently that is the case, that administrative law judges have the power to do that. Also, if you look at, but if you don't have it in your state statute here now, not on this version, but if you take a look at under current 1339 subdivision 3, the current language says any civil investigative data presented as evidence in court or made part of a court record shall be public. It's adamant. But now we're saying that, well, if it's under subdivision 4, notwithstanding subdivision 2 or 3, which is the language that I just indicated, a civil investigative data made part of a record of a proceeding in the court could be placed in by a court order, as otherwise provided by law or court rule. I think, as already said, Ms. Byer-Kempinski has come a long way, even from the Senate Delete Everything amendment that was done. I think there are just a number of items in here that I think cautiously need to be talked about a little bit more. And the process, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was done by a number of state attorneys, got together, put it out, granted, it's summer and all that. But one of the other things that is so important, as Ms. Byer-Kempinski did a couple of years ago, she asked a lot of stakeholders to come together
and to deal with a lot of issues, and one of them was the 25-cent copying fee, which has now became law. There are some other issues there, and there was a good discussion, what should go forward, what should do this, and what about that. And I think this is one of those things that this should happen with. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are my comments.
Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? All right. Any additional testimony for or against from the audience? Ms. Wierzynski, do you want to make any comments or reactions to this?
Madam Chair, members, I just want to remember that stack that Mr. Neumeister had. That means things aren't clear, so that I hope that we can at least get to some of the pieces that would make it clearer. Because part of the thing with our stakeholders being both the citizens, the media, to the government attorneys is, on some policy issues, they will never agree. But that at some point they can all agree, yeah, I understand what this language means and I can apply it and it can be applied fairly to all people. So that's really the goal, is how do we get something that everyone can understand and use. This is certainly a large area of discretion given the chief attorneys, but I don't believe that chief attorneys misuse it wildly. I think as officers of the court, they're not supposed to lie. So one of the things we took out from the Senate side was a reasonableness standard for the chief attorney, and certainly if the members wanted to say the chief attorney has to reasonably determine that a civil action is pending, I would be supportive of that, and maybe you would be supportive as well, because certainly the Senate seemed to feel that no standard was better than a reasonable standard.
Okay, on that note, I could go there, but I'm not. any questions for Ms. Byers-Pinsky? Okay. Simon, where do you want to put this
time? It's decision time. I mean, I'd appreciate if committee members have some comments about this. This is important to air this because this is a big, big issue. So whatever we do tonight, I think this is a really key part of the whole act. You know, I know that it's been tabled in the Senate. That ought to inform our decision, and I don't know. I'm putting a lot of people on the spot here. I wonder whether or not this could use some more kind of stakeholder action before or meeting before we actually put it in the bill right now. I'm putting you on the spot, Ms. Byers-Pinsky, but could you comment about that? How time-sensitive is this, other than, of course, the sooner the better?
Ms. Byers-Pinsky.
Madam Chair and members, that was one of Senator Limmer's questions. Explain the urgency to me of this. And certainly, these two sections have been around for more than 20 years, and they have caused consistent problems since then. So it's certainly not anything new. Tomorrow is not going to be any better than today. At some point, it's really hard to get these kinds of things addressed and through the process when you've got stakeholders who are always going to be at opposite ends of the fence. So we can continue to try and do that, but at some point, I think the policy decisions have to be made by folks like you.
Representative Simon, maybe what might be a plausible option would be to move this separately without recommendation back to Bill Mullery's committee, and then you could give you some time to work it out, see if anything at all is moving in the Senate. That way you still can put it into the data practices base bill in Representative Mullery's committee, but if you find out tomorrow that nothing's going to happen in the Senate and they want to work on it over the interim or whatever, that certainly would allow that flexibility as well.
Madam Chair, I think that's a great idea. I think we should do that.
Would you like to amend your...
I will. I'll amend my motion so that we move the bill separately so that House File 3787 be moved not as an amendment to 3553, that was the original one, but this motion is that 3787 be passed without recommendation to the Public Safety and Civil Justice.
And that, I assume, would be 3787
as amended. Correct.
All right. Any questions on the amendment or on the motion? I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure Representative LaForest said that we're going to suffer the same pain in another committee.
Actually, we'll get to listen to Representative Emmer on this one. Anyway, I look forward to that. But all those in favor of moving House Bill 3787 as amended without recommendation to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Law, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Representative Simon, I don't know if I've lost my agenda here on the stuff. I don't even know if we've covered all your bills yet. Or
we have. I think we have, Madam Chair. And at this point, there are two sort of floating amendments. One is the XXX, which represents a bill that was thrown in the hopper but not in time, I think, for today's bill introductions, but for tomorrow, having to do with Hennepin County Medical Center. And then the second one, I believe you, Madam Chair, had, which had to do with the recent temporary classification. I think you have that one, Madam
Chair. Right, and I do. And then we also have a Hillstrom bill. Has that been pulled?
No, that's been pulled.
Okay. All right, well, let's take up the 808-1317 amendment, which has to do with, I think it's HCMC, is that correct?
Correct.
Or is it all public hospitals, or would you like to phone a friend?
Madam Chair, we have a testifier here. I will phone a friend, but I think it's all public hospitals. It was done at the urging of HCMC, but I'm sure others qualify.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you'd state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Mitchell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and my primary client is Hennepin County Medical Center. With me in the back of the room is Joanne Sunquist, who is the Chief Information Officer, and Kathleen Putler, who is the Director of its Electronic Health Record Project. We are here. First, I want to say I'm a novice here, and I want to commend you all on your patience. It's quite a process. I'm glad to say that the amendment that we are championing is not an amendment to the data practices bill. Rather, it's an amendment to Minnesota Statute Section 383B.917. And 383B.901 and the provisions that follow it are the provisions that were enacted in 2005 that allowed Hennepin County to create a public subsidiary corporation called Hennepin Healthcare System, and that's what currently operates the hospital. So this legislation is specific to Hennepin County Medical Center as it's now being operated by this new corporation. And here's basically the problem that we're trying to solve. In Hennepin County, we now have Hennepin County Medical Center as a public corporation under the county. The county also owns other clinics, and let's take, for example, North Point Health and Wellness, which serves the north side, long-standing historical clinic, but they are separate from Hennepin County Medical Center. And then at Hennepin County Medical Center, we have a faculty group that services all of our patients. So it's a private, nonprofit corporation. We at Hennepin County bought an electronic health record system for the hospital some years ago, a tremendous expense and tremendous time and energy to install this and get it up and operating. It's now operating in the hospital, and the contract allows us to provide the same electronic health record system to our affiliates. The first affiliate to whom we provided it was Hennepin Faculty Associates, this private nonprofit corporation that works with our patients. And there's pretty much a complete overlap of patients there, so that was not really an issue. Now we want to add North Point to the equation, and the issue is that we don't want to run afoul of Data Practices Act's prohibitions against North Point sharing its data because it's a part of this electronic health record with Hennepin Faculty Associates, which is not under its umbrella. So this statute amendment does three things. First, it says that a nonprofit corporation providing physician services to the corporation, and that is to the hospital, and participating in its electronic exchange of health records, may share medical data with other participants in the electronic exchange. This would allow North Point and Hennepin Faculty Associates, which already share, by the way, a large number of patients, but it would allow them to share their data in this electronic health system, but only for the purposes of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. Second part of the bill second sentence, talks about related health care entities. And there is a provision in existing law that allows related health care entities to use share data for the purposes of the current treatment protocol. So North Point, which is owned by Hennepin County, and Hennepin County Medical Center, which is also under the umbrella of Hennepin County, are related entities. But Hennepin faculty associates would not be. And this would just be to bring them into that circle so that we could share that data for that purpose. And then finally, the last clause is that these other participants would not be considered outside of the hospital's facility for the purposes of 144.651. And that's the Health Care Bill of Rights, and it says that a facility, which is a hospital in this case, shouldn't share its data outside without consent. But to do this electronic health record, we would want that consent at the time that they sought care, but the information would already be provided. So this is an amendment specific to Hennepin County Medical Center to try to deal with these complexities that exist because of the way the corporation is structured and its relationship to a nonprofit and then to other public entities.
Okay, a couple questions. Because this amends, I'm assuming, the section that governs HCMC, when you use the term corporation, you're talking about the hospital, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then talk to me more about consent of the patient. Do you have to get consent of the patient to mix your records back and forth between your different entities?
This would allow the sharing without consent it's sort of complex. This would be allowing you to share the data without consent, but here's how it would operate. For example, if a patient was seen at North Point and provided their home address and telephone number, etc., and then that same patient were later to call HFA, the registrar at HFA would not be allowed to see any of their medical data, but when they typed in their name, assume it was me, Andy Mitchell, they type in the name, on their demographic screen it would come up as to where I live. And so that they could verify that information or just ask for that information. And so that's the kind of information sharing that would happen without a consent. It would only happen when someone seeks care or treatment at the other facility.
Is anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against Mr. Neumeister?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I've been involved over the last few decades in helping develop the medical record privacy laws. One of the concerns I have, if you take a look on page 1, it says on how subsidiary on starting at 117, all the, you know, subsidiary joint venture association partnership or any other entity that is formed or that where they have any type of contracting, where they're contracting to an entity, they come under Chapter 13. And then all of a sudden, on page 2-1, they have the big notwithstanding Chapter 13. So for me, the ultimate question is, what kinds of individual rights that I, as a citizen, under Chapter 13, what will I be losing under this not being subject under Chapter 13? And that's something I have not seen Hennepin County folks bring to that attention. At least I can see possibly some, you know, the issues of consent. The informed consent is an important part. Number two, the challenge of accuracy and completeness of data. There's some other elements, and I'm not too clear about that. So that's one of the concerns that I have. And also that it has already been talked about in discussion. The language, again, is to nonprofit. It doesn't say North Point. It doesn't say HFC. It doesn't do any of those kinds of things. Now, one of the things I have concerns about, as Madam Chair and members of the committee, as you may remember last year, of this whole issue where we have given the authority for exchange of medical records electronically,
but there was a lot of pros and cons about that, and it's expanding. So I don't know what HCMC's future plans are. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, those are some of my concerns.
Thank you. Any questions from the Minister? Anybody else like to testify for or against this bill? I have a couple more questions. For Mr. Mitchell. If in fact the situation that you explained, why weren't you on page 2 of the bill, line 3, instead of saying share medical data, why don't you just say share name and address? And the why, if you're just using it to find out where somebody lives, why do you have to share for treatment, payment, or health care operations?
Well, the reason we use medical data there is under 13.384, the medical data. It makes all of that medical data whenever you see a provider. So
it's very broad.
Right, but it's broad on the front end, so it catches that kind of data. We were trying to use the term that was used in defining that this address information was in fact medical data. So if you compare it with the Health Records Act, that kind of data is not considered subject to the Health Records Act. It is to the Data Practices Act because of the definition of medical data. So we were just trying to use that. We can certainly, you know, look at whether we can accomplish much the same goal with different language there.
Well, just saying, to me, I'm sorry, it just seems really broad, and I'm not sure you're getting the consent at the point where I think, from my standard, is that you should get the consent. I mean, I think that every patient should be able to consent to where their medical information is sent and what it's used for, or, you know, have that ability. And so I'm still not certain that once these people hit your system, that this bill won't just let you to move stuff back and forth without them knowing that.
Madam Chair, I hear your concern, and I'd like to think about how to address that. The problem we've been trying to deal with is that when a person calls over the phone and says, we were trying to prepare a script that said, would you consent to our accessing your data that already exists on our system? But, of course, that wouldn't comply with the Data Practices Act because a consent to be valid has to be in writing and dated, and these people are talking to us over the phone just trying to schedule an appointment. So we were trying to get across that hurdle, and then we're trying to get across a hurdle with kind of patient-level data that so that when they come in for their first appointment, we can ask for a deeper consent that gets the treatment data. But
explain to me why, I mean, when a lobbyist came and talked to me about this bill, it was presented that because you were a public hospital, you were treated different than if you were a private hospital. And so explain that to me a little bit more.
Well,
that's not seeming to be the issue at hand, really, as I understand it, so I must be missing something here.
Well, the primary distinction, I think, between us and most private hospitals is the Data Practices Act applies to us. And the Data Practices Act, in its definition of medical data, is broader, catches more data than the Health Records Act does. But one other distinction that I think exists in reality in most situations is that many of our hospitals in town are part of an affiliated group already, and we are not, your Allina hospitals are all part of the Allina clinics and hospitals, and so your electronic health records, those facilities, is available everywhere, and you just consent to have it be available at Allina. HCMC is a standalone, and so we're trying to deal with some of those issues, both with consents and otherwise, but to allow the folks who are treated by HCMC to get the benefits of this medical record, which are considerable, but to get it across the continuum of their care, not just when they're hospitalized, but when they're seen in clinics like North Point.
And
Can you give me an example? You said that the definition of medical data was much broader in Chapter 13 than it was in the Health Records Act. Can you give me an example of something that's pulled in Chapter 13 that's not in the Health Records Act?
I think the address of a patient is an example. That in the Health Records Act, I don't think the address, insurance, that kind of thing is deemed to be a health record as it is under the medical data in 383. That's my reading of it.
We have
all right.
No goodies tonight. So are there any questions for the witness? Okay. So
well, Madam Chair, this is one that I think we ought to include. And there may be some tweaking that needs to be done, but I'm sensitive to the HCMC's needs and the fact that they are treated differently, and it's more difficult for them to navigate this terrain. So,
and I understand that too, but I don't want to put the customers or patients of HCMC, give them less the rights than a patient going to another facility either.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, I would say, well, depends what you mean by I left. I mean, the standards are already tougher for the data because they're roped in as a public nonprofit, because they're roped into the Data Practices Act. I think they are held to a stricter standard. And so, well, I guess it depends
on.
Yeah,
and like I said, as the bill was explained to me and what I see in front of me, there's a different nuance to it. And so, not having had time to digest it or really think about it, I don't know, but I would just express my concern that we make sure that people still retain their right to authorize particular use and that their medical records aren't just floating around from clinic to entity to hospital to corporation or whatever without the patient having a right to consent to that or to deny that from happening as well. If there's no other question or testimony on that particular issue, you would read. Representative Simon will renew his motion that post file.
No.
Oh, we're amendment. I'm sorry. Amendment A081317 be adopted to the omnibus data practice bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. I think at this point we're down to an amendment of mine. Hopefully, I will only take back that what I brought.
Okay, members, this is truly the home stretch. This is it. This is the last item we're taking up. Unless there are other amendments I don't know about. So, Representative Holberg, you have an amendment?
I do, and I'm trying to find the right one. I believe it's the A8 amendment.
That's what I have.
Yes. And this relates, some of you may have seen the article in the paper about the temporary classification that the Commissioner Administration did that made all the data, if I may discuss here, but basically there was a request by, hang on, I'll find it here, MPCA. For temporary classification relative to the climate change group, and that temporary classification said that the information is private. This is a temporary classification that was issued on February 21st of 2008, and it's a pretty major change in policy, and that all of this has been public, and it is for affecting things like planning commissions, curriculum committees for school districts, watershed districts, volunteer, and in fact, so what we've done here is an attempt in the A8 amendment to flip it back to what the statute's always said, is that this information was public, but still address the privacy issue for those that do not want their private information available to the public, but still be able to facilitate exchange of information and feedback with members of these groups. Because if they're in some type of board or commission or committee, you'd hope at least the majority of the time they're trying to work on behalf of the public interest. And if you totally cut off any method of contact, you really thwart the ability of the public to participate in any way in these groups. And so we turn it back and say that everything is public, but give individual members the option to opt out, if you will, to a private status. And if they do that, then the public entity, i.e. the city, the county, the MPCA, the Soil and Water Conservation District, whatever that the commission works for, would then have to provide an alternate snail mail and or email address for the public to use, and it would be the responsibility of the individual to check for mail or information. And so we tried not to burden the local units of government with the responsibility of actually disseminating the information coming in, but allow for that privacy to be addressed while still giving public access to individuals. And it's a first attempt, but I feel really strongly that the advisory or the temporary classification is going to cause huge problems for thousands of people and hundreds of entities that now have set all this stuff out in the public realm, and how do you bring it all back? And in talking with various communities, the city of Lakeville, they have always allowed their members to control what went out and have kind of an opt-out. So I mean, I think they've been dealing with this privacy issue on some level, but this would then undo the temporary classification, which I think is not workable if you believe that the public should have access to these individuals.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Anyone else here with testimony for or against the amendment? State your name and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. I'd like to talk about these two sections separately. The first one was a provision that was in the data practices bill last year, but it didn't have, I believe it didn't have a full hearing on this side, so that was held. This was also a result of a commissioner's decision. Applicants for if you have a vacancy on your city council, a vacancy on the school board, and you want to apply, that data used to be treated as personnel data, and it got recodified to the 13.601. Well, when it was in the personnel data section, it said these things are public and everything else is private, just like it always does. When it got redrafted over here, if you see the language, it says the following data on all applicants for election or appointment to a public body are public, and then it listed those. It didn't say anything about anything else, and the commissioner's opinion said, well, that's one list of things that are public, but everything else that you have about them is public as well. And we believe that was just a drafting error, and we would support Section 1. We think that's what you intended to do when you moved that. It would say that everything is private except for their name, address, education, training, employment history, volunteer work, awards and honors, and prior government service. So we think that's I don't think that's a controversial issue. In the second section, I believe I understand what Representative Holberg wants to do. I think, however, the language may have overshot the mark. And if you look at the language on 1.13, it says, upon election or appointment to a public body, all data held by the government entity on the appointee or elected official are public, including home address, telephone number, and email address. That would mean anything that they have about you would be public. I think what you were trying to get to, if I'm not mistaken, was their contact information. For instance, let's take your Lakeville example. If I went to Lakeville High School and graduated from there and they maintained those educational records on me, in theory, if they still had those records, this would make them public. I don't think that's what you intended. If you had any of your personnel data, if you'd been an employee of the city, and now you went on some advisory thing, everything that was in your personnel file on this would become public under this. I think that the better way to address the issue that I believe you said you wanted to address would be on 1.13, instead of saying all data, to say all contact information held by the government entity on the appointee or that is public.
Mr. Chair, I think I recognize that we can't go with all data, but I do think application information, I think that certainly the presumption should be that all of this information is public, but to the degree that we need to keep their identity their location for public safety reasons. But I do believe the public has a right to know what criteria were considered for their appointment. I think the public has a right to know more than just the name and contact information.
But sure, I don't have any problem with that. But this goes way beyond that.
And I understand
this,
that.
This one shoots too far.
Representative Holberg, would you entertain an oral amendment along the way? Well, will you make an oral amendment?
Sure.
To your amendment.
Why don't you make it, just so we're clear?
Well, I hate doing this on the fly. It's worth it. How about we say can't have the smoking behind the football stadium can't be included in that. Oh, that would be the part of the school record, I guess. Let's see.
Well,
I think it has to do something. Oh, Mr. Aaron's going to help me, I bet. Yeah. No? He's had a long day, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I was wondering if you said on you kept all data, but then on line 14, after public, you said relating to the official or appointee's public duties or public responsibilities.
Ms. Chair, I don't think we would know how to interpret that.
I don't think we'd know what.
I think
we
could list. Let's see.
Well,
so you got to take the all out of their data held by the government entity on the appointment. Or elected official.
President Holder, might I suggest saying all application data?
Right.
Just insert the word application after all and before data.
That works. I guess it's closer. We're probably not there yet, though, but personalized probably.
Would you like to move that oral amendment?
I would.
Okay. Any comments? Okay, all in favor of Representative Holberg's oral amendment to her amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Okay, the amendment is adopted. So we're now on the amendment as amended. Any comment to the amendment as amended?
And as you can see from the timestamp, I'm
there. Right. 5:14. Wow. I would just say, too, just for the record, I think this is a great idea because how many hundreds or thousands of people are on commissions across the state, and to say that the public can't get a hold of them, I mean, some smart person in some locality or jurisdiction is going to say, let's just defer the really tough controversial issues to a commission, and then nobody will really get at them, you know. All the pay raise issues and everything else will go to this commission, and no one knows how to get a hold of these people.
Well,
I'm sure that's not what was intended, but it sure looks like that's the result that we're headed towards. So,
I know there's issues. Some commissions are much more high profile and are dealing with very emotional issues. But quite frankly, in some of these small communities, everybody knows where Joe Smith lives. His farm's on the corner of such and such road, and all of this rigmarole of keeping things private that are really out there in the public realm for the most part anywhere. Anyway, I think puts a really big burden on the school districts, the cities, the counties, the different organizations. It's just unworkable.
Any other comments, members, on this amendment? Okay, hearing none. All in favor of the A8 amendment, please say
aye.
The A8 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No. There's too much consensus tonight.
the amendment is adopted. The amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Mr. De La Forest, or Representative De La Forest, I'm surprised since I've been here, you've always had the amendment every year to up the penalties. But I'm not going to suggest that to you this year.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been beaten down on the issue. I'm hoping that we'll get this to a conference committee at some point, and then I'm going to actually try to get on the conference committee. This time, apparently that's the trade-off. I'm told that if you're on the conference committee, so I'm willing to bear the burden.
All right,
thank you, Representative De La Forest.
We have no other amendments, so now I will renew my, I think it was my original motion, that House File 3553, as amended many times, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion is adopted. Members, I think we are adjourned. Thank you.